Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Memorial Day edition of The Download, sitting in for Justin Kaufman. It takes two to sit in for the great Justin Kaufman. We have my fabulous friend, Mr. Mark Caro.
Hello.
And I'm Chris Jones, and we're with you all the way through 11 o'clock. We have a packed show. We're going to talk about Philip Roth and Tom Wolfe, TV finales. We're going to talk about restaurants. We're going to talk about stand-up at Second City. And we're going to sort of talk a lot about the future of restaurants, because Mark and
we were
at the restaurant show.
Robots and restaurants. And the Sweets and Snacks show. So Chris and I, you and I did the double header over at McCormick Place, where it's otherwise known as Halloween for Adults. The restaurant show, the NRA show, which they're not that keen on the acronym anymore. It just shows all the sorts of, you know, it's just amazing how much, right, that is, you know, how much of the industry is, how many different specialized things there are, pieces of equipment, types of food preparation, ways you can serve food to the masses at a time when service is bigger than ever and more people want to go out than ever. And then Sweets and Snacks is just all of the sweets and snacks that could take up, you know, huge floors of McCormick Place.
So this is the Sweet and Snack Show and the National Restaurant Show, both of which kind of wound up in the last few days at McCormick Place. They kind of run at the same time, because I guess some people, it's the same, it's sort of parallel businesses. Like some people go to one, some people go to both.
Right. And then you all have to exercise when you're done. And we brought back some snacks. So we're going to offer our guests snacks, and we'll probably ask Camille if she wants some. We got Crick Start, which is real food made with crickets. And this one is cinnamon cardamom. It's still in the wrapper. See, someone's going to get to this. That's the actual real wrapper. And I like that it's real food made with crickets, because if they sold it as like fake food, you wouldn't want to buy it. And it's organic too. And so I'm not quite sure the organic harvesting of crickets, but.
If you've never been to either the restaurant show or the Sweets and Snacks show, you are simply not mentally prepared for the scale of it. It is acres and acres and acres. And it has a bit the impact of making you think there are no new ideas in the world. Because, like, if you want to make a chip, there are already 50,000 people making chips in every conceivable color, size, deviation, derivation. It's kind of, you know, it is hard to make a splash in America, I'm telling you.
It is. And we brought in a lot of those chips, in fact. And it was interesting because there weren't that many potato chips. I think that, you know, there was like the steak flavored ones now. And then there's the Stubbs barbecue as well as the other barbecue. And there are all sorts of different flavored potato chips. But I think now all the action is the different kinds of chips. So here we have the Blazing Buffalo Nana Chips. So this is a spicy banana chip. Here you have Pitos. P-E-A-T-O-S. It's like a Cheeto, but made with peas, and it's the World Peas brand. And in fact, the hashtag is unjunk your snack. Whatever visual that
snacks,
brings to mind.
Healthy snacks are a thing. And the other thing, you know, there's a lot of pop snacks, which are like basically, right, what is a pop snack? It's like a chip with air inside, right? Am I right?
All the pop chips were really big a few years ago. Now there are all these popped rice things. And then just popcorn. I got two different brands here of small, there's one here called Pipcorn, which is as featured on Shark Tank. And it's Pipcorn Truffle Delicious Mini Popcorn. And there's a little thing that says actual size, just so you know what a small kernel of popcorn would look like. But yeah, so the smaller kernels, we'll try them. We'll see if they're crispy.
Is truffle good? I know. It's like, you know, I go to a posh restaurant, it always says truffle fries. And I never know whether to be pleased or disappointed that the fries
are
like
truffles.
Fries. If you're truffle?
A high-end, what is truffle?
Like, with fries. If you're having truffle fries,
what a truffle is, right?
Vaguely,
you know, the pigs.
Very vaguely.
Are there these very, very precious, expensive, buried... You know, it's like a dense mushroom. But whatever I say now, all the foodies are going to be like, they're white truffles and black truffles. And the white truffles are more expensive and delicate. And the black truffles are a little more... you know, a little more flavorful. Pigs, dig them up. They're very expensive to harvest. The restaurants will shave truffles. If you go to Spiaggia, they will shave truffles onto each of your entrees, and it'll cost more, but then you'll have this rich experience. And it's kind of like a higher-end mushroom, basically. It'll just sort of melt. It has a sort of melty quality. It's the foie gras of mushrooms. A truffle is to a mushroom what foie gras is to liver, without being, you know, having any force feeding of animals involved.
All right, so
that for an
that's very, very good. So in the next hour, we're going to sort of spend a lot of time really on more substantial topics than truffles and fries, on the future of restaurants. So tell us about our guests. Who are we going to have in? Who's going to talk about the future of restaurants?
We are going to have Sarah Stegner, who's a wonderful chef at Prairie Grass Cafe, and she's going to come in. She owns her restaurant in Northbrook, used to be at the Ritz. And then we're also going to have Eddie Lakin from Edzo's.
Oh, yes.
So we're going to hear – so Chris, you and I saw this presentation, and one of the things we saw was Flippy the Burger Flipper, and it was a robot. It was a burger flipping robot, because the argument was that, hey, nobody really wants these jobs. If you have robots flipping burgers and serving people, then all the customer service people can do other things to make people happy other than taking their orders and delivering their food and making their food.
Yeah, because there was Flippy and also this robot Patty or Patsy or something that actually delivered your food,
right?
Like a Rumba. It was like a Rumba vacuum, only if you imagine it was big and it delivered your food. So
right.
The runner,
and they were two different, and those are two different, and it was funny because there were two different companies, right? The Flippy was the burger chain, but then the other one was some other chain, and there's some version of Flippy in that one too. So we're gonna ask Eddie, I want to call him Edzo because that's the name of his place, but we're gonna ask Eddie whether he thinks your robots could make those delicious Edzo's burgers quite so well.
All right, so all of that's in the hour coming up, and at 7:30, because we have the most eclectic show on the dial, ladies and gentlemen, we're gonna have Liz Taylor, the literary guru of Chicago. Gonna come in. She's gonna talk about the loss of pretty much two pretty great literary figures. Right, Mark?
Philip Roth and Tom Wolfe. And certainly when you think of your fiction and nonfiction, the towering figures of, you know, late 20th century would be those two, I would say.
So Liz is going to talk about
There are other ones too. I'm not, you know, not to exclusion of anyone, but these two are definitely legends. And Philip Roth was giving interviews earlier this year, and he seemed pretty, he'd retired from writing, but he had a very long career. Like he peaked a lot of times.
So if you're a fan of either of those two guys and you want to talk about that with Liz, she's coming in right in 7:30, just a few minutes away, 312-981-7200. You can call us, you can text us. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to The Download. It's Chris Jones here, along with Mark Carroll. We're sitting in for Justin Kaufman.
Hey!
And we got a packed show for you tonight. We're with you all the way through 11 o'clock. We're talking restaurants. We're talking television with the great Mo Ryan. And we're talking literary icons with the great Liz Taylor. That's coming right up at 7:30. And then we're talking restaurants. Then we're going to talk with Mo. And then we're going to have comedy in our last hour with some guys from Second City talking about the upcoming Breakout Comedy Festival. So we hope you'll stay with us if you're on your way back from this. This was a hot Memorial Day weekend, Mark.
Very hot. I wonder if this had anything to do with it, but did you go see Solo by any chance?
I did not see that this weekend.
That was not too hot. I didn't see, I don't mean like the quality of it, which I imagine maybe wasn't too hot, but it did not do so well. It's like the worst grossing of the Star Wars movies in the Disney Star Wars era.
I will say this, in my 20 odd years of living in the city, I have never seen more people on the North Avenue beach than there were.
Just now.
It was like, holy cow, it was a lot of people on that beach today.
Yeah, there were backups on all the exits.
That was crazy. I guess it's the first, it's a holiday night, and it's also the first.
What's the water temperature, though? I mean, like,
cold.
You can't actually go in.
Well, you can go in and risk hypothermia.
Stick your toes in. I mean, it would feel good on a day like today, but you'd have to do, like, the Nesty plunge and get right out, I would think. But I don't know. If you want to call in and tell us how the water was.
Oh, how crowded it was.
Yeah, 312-981-7200. Call or text 312-981-7200.
So in the theater world, unfortunately, a little bit of sad news tonight. Rachel Rockwell, who has been one of Chicago's really most prolific directors, not just at any one theater, but really at almost all of them. Chicago Shakespeare Theater, Goodman Theater, the Drury Lane Theater in Oak Brook, the Marriott Theater in Lincolnshire, unfortunately died today at the very young age of 49. And so the news is kind of coming out tonight. And a lot of theater people in the city are very, very distressed by the loss of Rachel, who really, I knew her pretty well, and I can honestly say this, Mark, there was no one I admired more as a director in Chicago. She was best known, you know, for family shows. She did Oliver, an amazing Oliver. She did an amazing Billy Elliot. If you at all ever go to those big suburban theaters, or indeed the ones in the city, or if you go to the family shows on Navy Pier, there was a pretty good bet that Rachel was the person directing that show. And it's just a, you know, it's just a horrific loss.
If you saw a show of hers, could you tell that she directed it without knowing?
So one of her things that she did, most amazingly for me, was she often had kids in her shows. Now, if you watch a lot of theater with kids, you'll know that often kids will do cute stuff kind of on, you know, on call, if you like, particularly a theatrical kid. But Rachel never let them do that. What she did was she always told them to be kids and to be real. I always remember watching, there's a sequence in Oliver. It's that very famous first sequence, you know, "Please, sir, can I have some food? Glorious food" is the song. And normally they'll come out and do little pre-programmed stuff. I've seen it like a thousand times. And when Rachel did it, it was like watching real kids getting food. And it that sounds like a simple thing, but it is really hard to pull off, you know.
No, getting kids to actually, because that's one of the most cringy things you could watch in any art form, is kids who are trying to act instead of kids being natural. And when they're natural, that's a real art, and it's a real testament to the director.
And it was the same at Billy Elliot, which, of course, is the, you know, the great show that was first originally done not by Rachel downtown in the original production directed by Stephen Daldry, but Rachel did a local version of it at Drury Lane, one of the greatest shows I've ever seen her do. And it was the same thing. It was capturing what it's like to be a kid in the theater. There was no better director in Chicago for a family show. And that's not to say that's all Rachel did. She did all kinds of different things. But what she did better than anyone else was entertain and bring art to all the family. And it was because she was upbeat, not just in person, but in her work and on stage. And it was, you know, it was just an amazing thing to see those shows. We're talking about Rachel Rockwell, Chicago area director, unfortunately died a little bit earlier today, actually, from cancer at the age of 49
right.
years old.
Yeah, no, too. And, you know, and Chicago is such a tight-knit theater town. And so these losses hit everyone really hard. It's not like so compartmentalized where like these
That's
people.
Right.
It seems like this will be another one. And there have been a few in recent, you know, months or years where it just kind of going to rock everyone. And this seems like one of them for sure.
So that's you know, a little bit of sad news today. It's kind of knocked me off my, feet a little bit today, that earlier on today. Equally, you know, another strange thing just happened. I just got this email from the Stratford Festival, which is this Canadian theater, Mark, and they just said that they had canceled their show tonight due to a bomb threat of The Tempest. Now, that's got to be, I mean, obviously people make bomb threats in all kinds of different places, but I don't
it's
quite,
like an epidemic at
I don't
point.
Quite remember anyone ever making one in a Shakespeare show. I mean, that's just another kind of shocker. So,
and in Canada too.
But that, of course, things have been ticking up a little bit in Canada of late. So that's that. So what have you been seeing? Like, what have, you know, you didn't see Solo, but what have you been seeing?
I did not see Solo.
What are you recommending for the good people at the moment?
Well, you know, I did see. One of the things is we were watching The Fourth Estate, which premiered on Showtime last night about the New York Times.
Yes, yes.
And I think you and I are going to have a few things to say about that when Mo Ryan, our good friend, formerly the Tribune. And Variety TV critic.
She's coming in at 8 o'clock.
She's coming in at 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock. All right.
9 o'clock. So we can't wait for Mo, and we're going to talk about that. I saw U2 last week.
How
people
was
kind of down on U2. You know, U2 is like this would have been an interesting show for Chris Jones to see here because the music worked better than the narrative. And you're like, well, you're going to a rock star show, so maybe you don't need a narrative.
They had a narrative?
They do have a narrative, and it's songs. They had their Songs of Innocence album, and then their Songs of Experience, and their journey, it's one of these things where they tell you the theme like a lot of times. And so Bono's talking about, you know, you need, I won't do the accent. But he, you know, basically your journey's from innocence to experience and then back to innocence, because you need to rediscover your innocence in order to get the true art going on, which would be a great narrative if people like these two recent albums of U2 as much as the ones that were coming out.
So in the show, how are they doing the narrative? So obviously they've got the albums, but are they popping out with dialogue, or is this scenic pieces, or how are they
kind of these narrated parts that no, but the scenery of it's really cool. As a state, it's a very staged production, which again, but to me the best part was when they were playing in a tight cluster on this tiny little stage at the United Center. So if you take the length of the basketball court, down where one basket is, there's a major stage where they usually would play. And then there's a long sort of runway that goes down to where the other basket would be, and there's a tiny circular stage. But between the two, aside from this runway, there's also a bridge, and the bridge would kind of go up and down, and there was a video screen, very high def, that ran the length of the floor. So Bono would be walking on this thing, and it would be like his town was passing him by. So he'd be singing about the town where he grew up, and or the street that he grew up, because he grew up in Dublin. But he'd sing about the street and this, and he'd be walking and singing, and then this kind of fanciful animated sort of or drawn version of his neighborhood would be passing him by. So it's kind of cool, but it was also, is that rock and roll, or is the rock and roll the part where they're just like standing in a cluster playing really hard? I'm kind of into that part of it.
Did it have any humility? Was it self-aware from that point of view?
It had humility in a sort of hubristic sort of way, in the way that Bono can do, where he would talk about, then we got our big heads, you know, and we got, but then they would have a thing where it would show them as superheroes, and it was like a comic strip of like how our heroes basically had their setback, but then they came back victorious. So it was still kind of full of itself, definitely into the whole self-mythologizing thing, but it sort of brings up, but at the same time, they're a very vital rock band, and there aren't a lot of bands that A, have been around just the original people for that long, and B, don't have additional musicians coming on. I mean, when Green Day comes on, they're a trio. I mean, there's only three people playing instruments, because Bono's not playing anything. So they're really filling it, and all those parts, I mean, The Edge is playing all sorts of things. So they're just one of the few that have the same lineup, and they don't augment it at all. And it's impressive, and they're an impressive band, but they're impressive, you know, they've been impressive like that for a while. But how many of their new songs are completely necessary? That's the thing that's always tough for every band when they've been around for that long.
All right, so that's U2. We're going to pivot from there and talk about Philip Roth, Tom Wolfe, Television, Restaurants. We got it all going on, and we will be right back. Hey, welcome back to The Download, everybody. This is Chris Jones and Mark Caro.
Hello.
We're in for Justin Kaufman. We're with you all the way until 11 o'clock. We've got all kinds of good stuff coming up for you tonight. We're going to be talking television. We're going to be talking restaurants. We're going to have comedy from the Second City all before 11 o'clock. But before that, even more exciting, right now in the studio, we have Liz Taylor, the longtime literary editor at the Chicago Tribune, also the author of a book that I don't mind saying I think is the most incisive book about Chicago perhaps ever written, American Pharaoh, which is the story of Mayor Richard J. Daley.
It's like the triple crown winner of Richard J. Daley biographies.
It is.
You spelled it right. And I was with you when it won the Belmont, because it was during the Lit Fest, and we were standing in Bar Louie, I think it was, watching it on TV, and we're like,
the Belmont, and yeah, I couldn't believe it. A Baffert horse winning the Belmont. Shocking.
There you go.
I might do it again.
Well, yeah, but it had been a while for the Triple Crown, but so the one named after your book, and so how much of a cut did you get on that? That's why they misspelled it, so then you couldn't make any sort of claim. Do you want a snack, by the way? We got some Pitos. We got some Blazing Buffalo Nana chips.
Or anything that has that sort of salty and sweet.
All right. I'm going to give you, and then we'll actually ask you real questions, but I'm going to give you some cinnamon and sugar millet and flax chips. I think these are pretty.
Are these sponsors?
No, we went to the Sweets and Snacks show, and we came back with stuff. Camille, what did you think of what you had? You had a little snack during the break.
I did. I tried the truffle popcorns, both of them. I like them a lot. And the Pitos.
The Pitos.
Yes. Those are really good.
All right. Oh,
this is my dinner, so thank you.
All right. That's well, really Liz, sad. We just want to say thanks for coming in on Memorial Day. It's greatly appreciated. Yeah, so we lost like two giants of the literary world, right?
Yeah.
With Tom Wolfe and Philip Roth. So Let me start by asking this. Which was the bigger giant of the list?
And it's like, Caro, you do that cage mech. So, I mean, it doesn't remind, let me just say, they are no Adams and Jefferson, right?
Right.
Thomas Jefferson, John Adams died and the same day and, yeah.
July 4th even.
Yeah, and we're kind of foes. They were just so different. The more I think about it, they probably were, had the same feel, the same enemy that Adams had for Jefferson and vice versa. I think for journalists.
Yes.
Wolf is the bigger one.
Why?
Because I think he influenced journalism so right. dramatically. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was actually at this book festival, and a Chicagoan, William Friedkin, was complaining about a writer. And he goes, that guy, he doesn't know that new journalism is dead, which is such a great line. Wolf inspired so many imitators.
It was just a different kind of writing. It was, if you're a nonfiction writer, which all of us in journalism are to one extent or another, you were definitely influenced by him because he just had such a way with language, and there was so much life in it and so much imagination in it. But it wasn't like he was making stuff up. And you read the right stuff, and there's a lot of the author in there, but it's also an incredible yarn. And then your electric Kool-Aid acid test, or all of these things where he was observing the 60s from a specific point of view, but really putting you in those rooms and
he was a reporter. I mean, he had worked starting out as a journalist for New York Magazine, so he really loved those telling details, those facts, and then sort of going from there. I think the fiction was well reported, but was weaker.
Bonfire of the Vanities sort of came out, and that was like, wow, this guy really captured the whole 80s zeitgeist. And from then on, the stuff just seemed kind of long. But if he'd only written Bonfire of the Vanities,
right.
and they hadn't made that terrible movie out of it,
right.
Then maybe he would also, that maybe, would be considered right. like this one it, right. great it, piece of
like,
fiction.
Yeah, if he'd stopped before I Am Charlotte Simmons, yeah. the one about Duke, and it was like old men writing about sex. Terrifying.
Which gets us right into Philip Roth.
Exactly. Very nice segue.
Thank you.
Oh, very nice segue. So there really are so interesting. In fact, I recalled that in 1989, Tom Wolfe did this really sort of very inflammatory piece called Stalking the Billion-Footed Beasts, the Literary Manifesto of the New Social Novel. And he slammed novelists for not writing sort of big social novels.
Right.
Kind of like he did. And people were troubled by that. But Roth didn't do those sort of big social novels quite, but he did do very political novels. And then politically, Wolfe and Roth, their worldviews were so completely different. Urban, Jewish, Roth, and Wolf was deeply conservative. Yeah. I mean, he was very, he won the Tribune Literary Prize.
Which means you're conservative.
No, that's not true. He shocked everyone by saying that, he was for the Iraq War.
Yeah.
He really, very, and also sort of as a person, was more conservative.
And these guys were very popular, right? Like a lot of people read them in a way right. that maybe, is there anybody now of that level of intellectual inquiry say that is actually that part? I mean, because these guys were not, you would go, people could talk about their work, a lot of people.
See, someone like Jonathan Franzen, but he only puts out books so infrequently, and they're so large. Like Roth was incredibly,
right.
and yeah. and like Plot Against America. I mean, that was 2004, so he was already over 70 years old when that came out, and that's one that people keep coming back to now because right. it's imagining what if Lindbergh had won the election?
Yeah, he was very political, and now at the same time, I mean, he was. he was a great novelist in many ways. But I don't know, a few days ago, a woman, Dara Horn, crystallized some what many of us felt about Roth. I had a hard time articulating. And she wrote this piece called What Philip Roth Didn't Know About Women
right,
Could
I
Fill
saw
a
that.
Book.
Yeah.
And
so
you know,
what didn't he know about women?
I think the women in all of his fiction, they were really, they were so flat.
Yeah.
There was just, there was, you know, there were no sort of interesting working women that he didn't, with his incredible psychological acuity, he focused it all on men. Mm. And these women were sort of limp on the page.
Why do you think that's the case? Why did he do that?
Well, I suppose maybe women just they didn't interest him. No. I mean, people follow their own curiosities.
No. Well, or that his characters struggle like he did with
right.
women. I think that he just didn't. I mean, it's such a male-centric point of view that he was putting forth, and he was sort of writing about these struggles of these men who don't understand women, and it just sort of came out that he kind of didn't in real life either, to maybe to some extent.
Right, and then one of his ex-wives, Claire Bloom, wrote about their terrible marriage,
right,
which didn't
right.
really help him.
Right.
He was not afraid to write very political books and to bring up issues about, you know, race and that, you know, were, you know, very interesting.
Now, did you enjoy them? Did you sit down with a Philip Roth, the young Liz Taylor? Not that you're not still young. The young,
you.
Even younger Liz Taylor.
And
did you really enjoy the books?
Oh, did I love Goodbye Columbus growing up? Absolutely. That was one of the first novels I thought was just explosive and fun. And it was great. I go for more of a doctoral.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He was more my sensibility, but I think that and the writing, I mean, his novels were just, I mean, the language, he was just so skilled sentence by sentence.
Yeah.
Whereas Wolfe, you know, he really relied on the flash of of the details,
right,
of the explosive sentences. And you know,
Chris, have you read Portnoy's Complaint?
No, I've never read that.
You've never read Portnoy? Okay,
no,
you have to go
I've read Goodbye Columbus. But,
yeah.
Portnoy's Complaint is very funny.
Yeah.
And Portnoy's Complaint is a different kind of writer, Portnoy's Complaint, than American Pastoral or The Counter Life or Plot Against America.
Or Human Stain.
Yeah, it's just because they get heavier as they get older. But you should go back and read Portnoy's Complaint. Because when I was younger, the younger me, I did read Philip Roth.
Even younger.
I read, younger me. I actually have a lot. The Ghostwriter is a terrific read. They were good reads.
All right. Well, we're going to come right back with Liz Taylor. We're going to talk also about the upcoming Printers Row Lit Fest. So if you've got that on your summer calendar, if you want a little preview of who's going to be there, what big names are going to be there, what exciting presentations can you find, don't go away. We'll be right back.
You recognize the song?
Welcome back.
What's the song? Hold on. No, there's a reason for that, even though it's kind
come
of
on,
a weird
Cher,
one.
Come on, you're such an intellectual.
Oh, it's
God.
It's Brian Ferry, The Right Stuff.
The right stuff.
And leading into the last segment was Paul McCartney and Wings' Letting Go, which is
a Philip Roth book.
Thank you.
I
was waiting for that. And if you want to call in and compliment the song bumpers, 312-981-7200. But join in the conversation. You can text us. You can call us up. Talk about literary heroes.
All right. So we have Liz Taylor in here with talking about Printer's Row. This is Chris Jones, by the way. Mark Carroll, we're sitting in for the great Justin Kaufman.
It takes two.
It does. It does, because he's that good. Okay, Liz. So coming up, the annual Printer's Row Literature Festival.
Is that how you pronounce it?
In Printer's Row. So, okay, down and dirty. If I don't, you know, what are the big, can't miss extravaganzas at the Printer's Row?
You should say when it is, too.
Yeah, when is it, actually?
The 9th and the 10th, right?
You got it exactly right. June 9th and 10th. Well, and Chris Jones, what will you be doing there?
What?
Yeah. You were doing
what am I doing? Things. I don't ever know what I'm doing. I'm doing David Cale. Yeah, the performance artist David Cale, who's I was actually cleaning out my old, cleaning out the basement, and I came across a piece, an interview I'd done with David Cale 22 years ago. So if you've been around Chicago for a while, he's been performing here for 22 years. Wow. So that's exciting. So who are the other?
Did you know that I interviewed Philip Roth?
When?
No, Tom Wolfe.
Tom Wolfe?
In his white suit. Yes, I did.
In his white suit?
Yes, in the middle of the day. No, at his house.
Where was his house? Where was, okay, now we're getting to the good stuff. Now we're warming up.
In a brownstone in the east side.
Was he nice?
And it couldn't be more lovely.
Oh.
He couldn't be more lovely. And
what do you talk about?
Well, actually, we talked about American studies, the idea of like that as a field. Anyway, oh. I know the right stuff was about to come out. And
the movie or the book? The book was about to come out.
The book, I guess. Yeah. I was a child. I was sent by Time Magazine and,
that's great.
To the famous man's house. And it was great. Anyway, but David Cale.
Who else is coming to Printer's Row?
Well, you're going to be interviewing a former Obama speechwriter.
Yeah.
David Kinane. We like to say it's very democratic. There's something for everybody.
Okay.
You got Joyce Carol Oates coming. You got David Ross, the catcher, who just his
David
15
Ross,
minutes,
the Printer's Row book,
the backup catcher who just won't go away because everybody loves him.
Yeah.
What has he written?
I was a backup catcher. Here's a book. Here's
David
a book
Ross.
About David
right.
Ross.
My life.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah. A product, maybe.
No, David Ross. Don't diss David Ross. He was their good luck charm because they haven't won the World Series since he left for June. Book is...
I hope you got a big... You better have a big tent for David Ross. I can imagine you got a big spot.
We're at Jones High School.
Oh, girl,
forget
Jones. Chris Jones High School.
Chris Jones
teammate,
High School.
My journey in baseball and a World Series for the ages.
Oh, so he's writing about his experience at the Cubs and all the rest of it.
He did that.
He's not writing about...
He was also on Dancing with the Stars,
Yeah.
He's not writing about Philip
Roth. Can you just show up for him? Or do you have to get a ticket in advance?
Well, now, I shouldn't be saying this on radio.
Oh, say
but
it.
We,
Come on.
You're supposed to get a ticket, but really, just show up. Just come.
Probably for someone like David Ross, it would be better to get a ticket, though.
Yeah. It's better to get a ticket. But really, there should be ample room.
It's a big auditorium.
Like Franken, I think that was like sold out. But in fact, there were 900. Oh, it's so sad.
Al Franken, but a year ago, Mark.
Just but a year ago. That's another show.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's good to have a ticket, but, even if there's a waiting list and people,
So a lot of people just like the ambiance, right? You just stroll around,
right.
Stroll around all the booksellers and all the. I always like the radical store. What is it? What's that radical Haymarket books, right?
Right, exactly.
And you can kind of, all these guys
are
here.
The Communist
book, Party. Right, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a great Chicago tradition.
I used to love going to the Brandeis book sale in Old Orchard.
Yes.
It was just a big thing, and they don't have... So this is kind of the closest thing where all the book people kind of hang out, and there are all the tents, and some of it's used books, and there are also really good movie posters you can look at, too. And all the events are indoors now, because it used to be outside in tents, so we're not in the tents anymore.
Yeah, yes, which I miss, but on the other hand, in 90 degree weather,
usually there's one day that's like today.
Right.
Hell yeah! And so,
in fact, I remember, can I just say, when my kids were little, I remember an almighty thunderstorm where people were like tents were falling up.
Yeah.
What year was this? I don't know. It was tents were falling over. It was the crazy. It was wild times.
Yeah, not good for books.
It was not good for books.
So, right, Tom Skilling was not there that year.
Right.
He should write a book.
Yeah, well,
Does
actually,
he have a book?
We speaking of that, Al Roker has a book on the Johnstown flood, believe it
does
or not.
It really?
But
oh,
he's not coming. Anyway. Oh, wow. But who is coming? So some really, we tried.
Stephanie, you got some chefs, I see. You got Sarah Grunberg and Paul Kahn and Stephanie Izard.
Yes.
Those are really good towering
people really,
figures here.
Yes. And Bayless is coming in the food, oh, yeah. You know, that whole food world. That's really.
Michael Imperioli from The Sopranos.
Now, that's a draw.
I think it's such a really cool book.
What is that book? So what? What
it's a
book
little
is,
novel. It's a really
a sort little of, novel.
No, it's very.
He's gonna rub
tightly.
You out. You call
no,
his
no,
mom.
No, no, no.
He's gonna come and take you out, Liz.
No, it's short and tense.
Like him.
It is. And so he doesn't have to carry a lot. It's I heard him at the LA Times.
He gets
festival.
Rubbed out
it was
at the
really,
end.
Yeah, exactly. It's really. It's very sort of urban and gritty. I really liked it.
What's he going to? He's going to read from it. Is that what he's
going to read and talk? But, you know,
so here he's in conversation with Steve Johnson.
Yeah,
there you go.
Talking.
Our Tribune colleague.
Yeah, right. So he's going to be talking about that book. But we're also try to have a little. That is actually a really good book.
Yes.
And then there's like some serious nonfiction. We have some. What I'm really excited about are sort of the interesting pairings. Like Natasha Trethewey has just moved to Chicago. She was a poet laureate.
Oh, great!
Won a Pulitzer. Huge, a very important poet. She's going to be in conversation with a friend of hers, actually. Kevin Young, who is the poetry editor of the New Yorker. So that should just be fantastic.
So I'm going to put you on the spot before we go, okay, because we're almost out of time.
Oh, my God.
So I put you on your spot. It's a beautiful, your summer's beginning. What is the one book that, like, if you know so much about books, Liz, what is the one book that you would say, okay, this is what you should be reading this summer? This is what you should be getting. This is what you should be
going. The summer book.
The summer book from Liz Taylor.
Okay, it's
or more than
I'm
one.
I'm going to be, so... I think
it's hard.
I'm partial because I adore her. But Rebecca Mackay from Chicago has just written this.
Rebecca Mackay.
MAKKAI. It's called The Great Believers.
The Great Believers.
And it's everything from the 80s, 90s, AIDS.
It's a novel.
In Chicago to Paris and the art scene in, you know, back to what Wolf is talking about. That's a big social novel.
All right. So Rebecca Mackay, The Great Believer.
And I'm really excited about that. But we also have like Jesse Jackson's coming because there's a new biography of Harold Washington.
This is the Printer's Row. But when is it, Mark Caron?
June 9th and 10th, which is a Saturday and a Sunday.
Fantastic. Liz Taylor, thank you for joining us on The Download. And we'll be right back.
All right.
Welcome back to The Download, everybody. This is Chris Jones. I'm here with my pal Mark Caro.
Hello.
We're in for Justin Kaufman. It takes two of us to fill the mighty shoes of Justin Kaufman, but we're with you on this Memorial Day evening all the way through 11 o'clock. We have a particularly exciting, I'm looking out here on a packed studio. If you're interested in restaurants and food, this is your hour. You wouldn't want to touch that dial. No, sir. So, Mark, we were at the National Restaurant Show. Very exciting. And sweets and snacks.
Right.
And we went to this thing together called
The Future of Restaurants.
Oh my God. It's a bit like the future of journalism. Not very good.
No, they're very. If you're not living in the future, Chris, you're living in the past.
That's right. I believe
that's
they
one
said
of the
that.
Things that we learned at the restaurant show. So we have some fantastic guests in the studio, but before I bring them on, I'm just going to set this up a little bit.
Yeah.
So the future restaurant. So there were four panelists, and the person who hosted it was a guy, Daniel Burris, whose official title was renowned futurist.
Very expensive title, that.
Renowned futurist. And he's also the author of The Anticipatory Organization, in case you want to go get that. And he did this whole presentation, and Chris missed a little bit of the beginning of it because he was getting his badge and stuff. So I want to tell you some stuff that you missed. Here's a quote. If you do what you've always done, you're going to get a lot less than you already have.
Okay.
So there's
I'll
one
bear
piece
that
of wisdom.
In mind.
Either you've got to be the disrupted or the disruptor.
Okay, I'll take the disruptor is a good one, right? Yes.
Disruptor is the good one, yes. And also, we're doing things that were impossible 2 years ago. So in 2 years, we'll be doing things that are impossible now.
Wow, it's deep. That's deep stuff.
So this is the future restaurants. But anyway, so then there were also these other people who were making these presentations, and there was a woman named Sarah Lockyer, and it was all about kiosks are going to you can order food off of kiosks or the tabletop tech, which is a tablet, and you do your order off of the tablet, and while you're finishing your meal, there will be like a photo of like molten chocolate cake, and it boosts the probability that you're going to order dessert. There's more, but let's bring on our guests right now.
Okay.
We have some wonderful food people here. We have Sarah Stegner, who is the chef of Prairie Grass Cafe.
That is
probably the restaurant I most consider home of any in the Chicago area.
Oh,
it is so
you.
Fantastic. And Sarah's not just because Sarah is a classmate of mine from the wonderful home of the Evanston Wildcats. And then, speaking of Evanston, you got Eddie Lakin, the owner chef of Edzo's Burger Shop, which are fantastic burgers and chips.
Where I have spent many a happy weekend hour, I have to say. Many a happy weekend hour.
You could do it on the griddle. You could do it on the grill. They're both going to come out really good. So, Eddie, one of the things that we saw was the Cali Burger. There was a presentation by this guy, John Miller, and he talked about they never talked about the quality of the meat or any of the stuff that I think of when I go to Edzo's, but they did talk about Flippy the burger flipping robot. Mm-hmm. And Flippy, there was a little video, and it showed Flippy flipping burgers on the griddle. And this way, he said, well, nobody wants those jobs. There's a labor shortage in the restaurant industry, and nobody wants those grill station jobs anyway. Flippy makes them perfectly every time. And then this way, you know, people can spend more time with the customers doing other things than flipping the burgers.
He was even wearing a little chef's. He had a little white,
yeah, the
white
image,
thing.
Yeah, they tried to make Flippy look like a robot chef with the apron. So, I don't know. Could Flippy work at Edzo's? How would that work out?
I don't think I could afford Flippy. Even
how much is Flippy? Do we know how much?
I don't know how much Flippy is.
Probably $100,000 at least. Wow. But Edzo's is a retro place, and we're all about doing things the old-fashioned way and doing them the way that it's harder and takes more labor and more attention to time, because things just taste better when that's how you do it. So we would never use Flippy because it kind of just runs completely counter to the whole philosophy of the restaurant.
When you're cooking a burger, are you doing it like, is there like a timer set, or is it more like you're just eyeballing it? Like, I know
it's
this
all
is
look
done
and
now.
Feel. It's look and feel. When we cook a burger on the griddle, we start with a ball. The ball gets seared on both sides, and then it gets smashed by a press. And then we wait to see the juices start to rise to the surface of the burger before we scrape it off the griddle with the putty knife and flip it. So
that's the key.
It's not always the same. It doesn't always cook at the same rate. It depends on the beef. It depends on who handled the beef, if they had a firmer touch when they were portioning it. It depends. Sometimes the griddle temperature fluctuates. Sometimes the humidity is different. So that's what cooks do, is cooks look at the food. They cook the same food over and over for years and years, and they get to know by look and feel and smell and sound what the food needs. And that's what a robot will never be able to do.
Let me ask you this. One of the things they keep telling us is that there's a labor shortage in the restaurant business, and you have intense labor in your restaurants, right? And they're also, so there's two things. One is there's a labor shortage. Two is that labor is getting more expensive. And three, this argument that these are jobs that people, I mean, the phrase they kept using there was they don't want, which, you know, bothered me on all kinds of levels. But what about that? Is it very difficult to get people to work at this grill that you're talking about right here?
No, it's not difficult. It's difficult to get people who are skilled and passionate and reliable to do it, but it's not difficult to get people to work in the restaurant. The money part of it is changing because we have new labor laws that are in place that dictate how much we have to pay people. Minimum wage and stuff like that is higher. So I can understand what people are getting at, but no, it's not difficult. I don't feel like there's a labor shortage. To some extent, I feel like the younger people that are willing to work for the hourly wage that we can pay, are the quality of the workers is not great.
Yeah.
As far as the millennials and their motivation level and their reliability and that kind of thing.
But what about this argument that millennials want technology, that they don't want to talk to you, they want to show their face and be recognized? You just think that's...
Yeah, I think that, you know, that may be true, but that's not what I'm interested in doing in the restaurant industry. For me, the restaurants are so about so much more than food. It's about personal contact. It's about making someone feel cared about and cared for. And all that is done through human contact. And so I don't really agree with that philosophy.
All right. Well, we're talking the future of restaurants right here on The Download, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Download. I'm Chris Jones. And I'm here with Mark Caro.
Hey.
And we are talking just a simple topic, the future of restaurants. We have a packed studio of gurus and practitioners and thinkers about the art and the craft. So, Mark Caro, let's get something going.
Yeah, we have Eddie Lakin from Edzo's Burger Shop was talking to us about how he's not going to hire Flippy the robot burger flipper. And Sarah Stegner from Prairie Grass Cafe in Northbrook is here as well. And Sarah, I want to ask you also this labor shortage thing. So one of the in this future of restaurants presentation that Chris and I saw at the restaurant show at McCormick Place last week, it was all like, yeah, well, if you get robots who can do the work in the kitchen, and then you get robots who could run. There's also like you get these like automated robots that have obstacle avoidance, I think was the phrase. And you put the food on it, and then it runs the food out to the table, so then the servers aren't getting all tired from going back and forth from the kitchen. And the way this was presented was your servers can just concentrate on public service because they don't have to take the food out, and they don't have to even take the orders because they have a tablet on the table. What do you think of all that?
I think if you take away the human contact in any point in the restaurant business, it makes it less special, less positive. That people doing their jobs in a passionate way, they want to see it go from beginning to end, and to have that, you know, that exchange between the customer and the server or the cook, it's all very positive, and it creates an environment that's about a community, and it's not just an impersonal, okay, I have this in front of me. It's us that cook that for you.
So do you have that feeling of there aren't enough people who want the jobs that you need them to fill?
I think the industry is correcting that.
What does that mean?
They have to be paid a fair wage.
Right.
Mm. The cooks have to be. It isn't just the chef that needs to garner some respect. It's all the way down the line. These are tough jobs, and they are very skilled. It is not something that you walk in and 6 months later, you're an expert at. Mm-hmm. This takes years to acquire the amount of skill you need to execute top quality food and to handle it carefully from beginning to end. And those jobs need to have some respect behind them, and part of that respect is money.
So one of the things at the restaurant show, that this is another sort of point that was made in this thing that Mark and I saw, was this idea of the millennials,
right,
who are ruining everything, just for the record. But millennials are millennials. They do want to eat restaurant food. In fact, they want to eat restaurant food pretty much all the time, but they don't really want to go to restaurants. So this has led to this explosive growth in takeout. And I think the figures they were saying was it was unbelievable.
And delivery,
right. Yeah. Takeout, delivery. In fact, delivery more than takeout, right, actually. And I think it was up something like 45% in 3 years. And they were all this dystopian vision of the future with these Amazon-like warehouses.
Virtual restaurants
where no one has a kitchen. They just lease space in a kitchen. And then a driverless car drives your Edzo's burger to you. So what do you think about that? You know, like, is you want people to sit there or not, you know?
No, yep. I mean, I agree with Sarah. I think there's a lot more to restaurants than just filling your belly with something satisfying. The whole experience is, the word restaurant comes from restorative. That it's supposed to be something that restores you and kind of brings you back to a better place than when you walked in the door. And that's been our philosophy at Edzo's forever, is that we want people to leave feeling better than when they walked in the door. So every aspect of the service, from when you walk in and we say hi, and then we take your order, and then you order the food, and then you get the food and you eat it, and then you say goodbye, all of those aspects are important. It's all part of the process of kind of putting a spring in your step and making you feel like you had – something special or that you had an experience that you can't get every day and that you just leave feeling happier and better and when more taken care of. So,
but is it hard to compete with these places that have all this technology?
No. I mean, I've had three corporate burger places open in Evanston since I started, and two are closed, right. And one is still going. Right. And they all felt like a Starbucks meets a Chipotle on the inside when they opened. Right. And they all had the video, plasma screen menus. And we have the old letters that you put into the channels by hand on our menu. I made a conscious choice when I started Edzo's that I wanted to be a non-corporate restaurant. When you walk, I wanted it to walk people to walk in and feel like, oh, how long has this place been here? Since the 60s or the 70s?
Yeah.
And you know, I have the role of the kind of like cashier, order taker that kind of gives you a hard time.
Grumpy. You are kind of grumpy.
I can be a little grumpy at times. I've seen you be grumpy. If someone's not following the protocol or if they're being inconsiderate to other customers, for sure I can get grumpy about that. And so I like that old school joint kind of vibe because those are the places I like to go to. So that was something I really wanted to create when I did Edzo's. And you know, that's robots don't fit into that model.
Yeah, I think almost more than being fed, you want the sense of community and you want the connection. And that you're not going to get that by somebody delivering food to you that's already an hour old.
Yeah.
You know, you want to have that experience. And I think the millennials want that more than anyone. They want connection.
They just don't realize it yet.
All right, we're here again with Sarah Stegner of Prairie Grass Cafe and Eddie Lakin of Edzo's Burger Shop. This is Mark Caro with Chris Jones. If you want to call in or text us, ask them a question, 312-981-7200. And pretty soon we're going to have Greg Hall, the founder of Virtue Cider and Goose Island Beer, is going to join us as well. So he's coming up. But Sarah, I wanted to ask you, so do you deliver or do people say, I want this to go, and do you say no, or is this actually a part of your business you have to consider now?
We do a consistent to-go business. We did try delivery, and it didn't really work. And it didn't work for us. But we do. People come and pick up, and they often come and pick up when they can't get into the restaurant that it's too busy.
Yeah, but you don't have like a Grubhub thing where it's getting delivered for you or something like that?
It didn't work. I mean, our food is about, you know, sitting down and really appreciating what's on the plate and the local product that we've brought to the table. And I think people respect that and want to come in.
I ordered from Lao Sichuan over the weekend, and it was, you know, because I had people from out of town, and I wanted to sort of say, on one of our best Chinese restaurants, the owner is in the slammer. That was, you know, what I wanted to say. Anyway, so there was that. And I do like Lao Sichuan a lot, but it was cold. It was, I mean, it was really not warm. That, you know,
Did you go pick it up or?
No, they delivered it, yeah. But it was not, you know.
I mean,
it was,
delivery of Chinese food is pretty old school. So, I mean, like that actually is something that's done.
I know, right?
But yeah, I don't like any of that. I don't know.
No, I don't either.
You know, we say the number one thing that people come back to a restaurant for is not the food. It's name recognition. You walk in, really? I say, hi, Mark Caro, how are you?
Oh.
You're going to come back.
I've gone on with Chris about this, coffee shops. Like, there are all these coffee shops where you walk in twice and they know you, and then there are other ones I've been in 100 times and they're like, what's your name? And it makes a difference.
It absolutely does make a difference. It goes back to the personal connection and then what I'm invested in making happen for you.
So that both of you own independent restaurants, a burger place and a, you know, kind of upscale, family-oriented, but adventurous, really sort of getting that balance of farm-to-table versus pleasing anyone who will walk through those doors. Is it harder to be an independent restaurateur now than it was 5 years ago, or is it pretty much the same?
I think it's challenging. I do think it's challenging, the cost of food, sourcing locally, and staying on point with that. You know, you're endlessly being challenged financially for that. But that said, our business right now is stronger than it was 5 years ago. So I'm not complaining.
All right. Well, we got to take a quick break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
But it's time to move away.
Welcome back to The Download, everybody. I'm Chris Jones, here with my pal Mark Caro. We're back on the air, as we were last Memorial Day, in fact, sitting in for the great Justin Kaufman.
It's our gig. It's like the Indy 500 on Sunday, and Chris and Mark fill in for Justin on Monday.
Because he's there.
With snacks.
He's there eating a burger, and we're talking about burgers. In fact, from the 773, we just had a text, it's just burgers, people. So we'll just bear that in mind.
Well,
is that a pro burger or an anti burger statement?
There's no such thing as just burgers right now. Everyone knows that because burgers are much bigger.
So coming up at the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to be talking television with the great critic Mo Ryan from Variety, most recently, and the Chicago Tribune as well. And 10 o'clock, we're going to be interacting with comedy from the Second City. But right now, Mark Caro, we've got this whole fabulous hour entirely dedicated to restaurants and where it's all going,
and we're at Greg Hall to the mix. Welcome, Greg.
Hey, Greg.
Hey, guys.
So Greg is the founder.
Hey, Sarah.
There you are. Say hey, guys, again. So I don't think it came out.
Hey, guys.
There we go. Greg started Virtue Cider, which is one of my favorite. We had the Creek Virtue last night. That was like the fancy one with the fancy imported cherries when we had our little barbecue last night. That was fantastic. And we also have Sarah Stegner of the wonderful Prairie Grass Cafe in Northbrook. And
hi.
Eddie Lakin of the fabulous Edzo's Burger Shop, which keeps conquering the big corporate burgers because they're just too fantastic. So that's and while we were on break, we were passing around some of the sweets and mostly snacks from the Sweets and Snacks show, getting some expert palates on this. What did you guys like just now that we just passed around?
Okay, you said that we should try these two with the truffles.
Right, so identify what they are because you have the bags. There's pipcorn. And then there's Little Kernel. They're both Little Kernel popcorns. One of them tastes a lot more like truffle than the other.
But there is a big difference because one is black truffle and one is white truffle.
Which is a good one? Black truffle.
This is the white truffle and this is the black truffle.
White truffle's fancier.
White truffle's fancier.
Can you taste the white truffle?
And it's non-GMO popcorn, too.
What's non-GMO mean?
Yeah.
Is that no growth hormones or
anything? Yeah. That's something. Right.
Okay. So which one did you like more of the two, taste-wise?
Well, I liked the pipcorn, but it does have a stronger truffle flavor, the other one.
A Little Kernel.
Yeah, I like the other one better. I think they just use enough salt in the other one. Most of these products didn't have enough salt, in my opinion.
Did you like the shiitake mushroom chips?
No, they were really bad.
Not especially.
Greg, what was your favorite there?
I didn't get to the popcorn yet, but
I'm talking.
No, I don't know. They all look interesting, but I don't know if we'll see them here next year.
And we still have the unopened Crick Start bar, which is real food as opposed to fake food made with crickets. And this one's cinnamon cardamom, and it's organic.
Have you ever eaten crickets, sir?
Yes, I have.
And what? Tell us about eating crickets.
They were very crunchy, and they were in tacos, and it was a great experience that I don't need to repeat.
All right, well, this is ground-up crickets. I don't know. There's no crunch in it. I'm going to pass this around if you guys want to try it.
All right.
You could just sort of give your feedback, and
you
in
said
the meantime,
there's no crunch?
It's more like one of those.
It's got the texture of a power bar.
Yeah.
Is it good?
I'm going to try it.
Is it good? Will we see it on the menu at Edzo's?
You could put it in a milkshake.
You could.
Yeah, it tastes like a cookie. It's not bad. It's like a cinnamon oatmeal cookie kind of a flavor.
Sarah passed it back and forth to Greg.
But I'm going to take a second bite, actually.
I always remember
you. Did you try it? The cardamom is really nice.
Speaking of milkshakes, you always had a thing, right? When I would see you get grumpy, which I did many times. In fact, you're personally grumpy to me on a couple of occasions.
Uh-oh.
Well, now here we are on the radio.
He's always been nice to me.
No, he's grumpy to me.
He's a gentleman.
Grumpy. You had a thing about you wouldn't have a milkshake with a flavor you could not embrace, as I remember. Like, if you couldn't find the natural flavor, you had this whole really totalitarian thing on milkshakes.
Quality control.
I'm not going to have this milkshake unless it's really
good. Trying to remember what flavor it was that you're talking about that must have inspired that rant. But I can't remember.
But it was like, if it's not a fresh flavor, then you didn't.
Oh, it's because of the strawberry.
That's right. What it was.
We don't have a strawberry shake on the normal menu.
That's right.
We only do strawberry shakes when I can get fresh strawberries from the farmer's market right around now, this time of year. So
that's
on
awesome.
Saturday,
cheers to you.
I go to this farmer's market. I buy two flats of strawberries. We macerate them a little bit. We puree them. And then we put a ton of it in with the vanilla ice cream. And it's the best strawberry milkshake you've ever had in your life.
And the rest of the year,
and then 3 weeks later, when the strawberries are gone and they don't taste the same, I stop buying them and we don't have it.
So no red goop?
It's seasonal. Yeah, no, we don't want to buy the frozen fruit products or whatever it is, the purees.
Chris called you totalitarian for that. What is up with that?
I'm just a seasonal guy being a chef.
Fair enough.
That's all it is.
Fair enough.
So, you know, Greg Hall.
Sarah was in on this before any of us, but the whole farm-to-table thing, you know, I'd like to say we're in kind of the year or the time of Providence, where stuff comes from really matters to the diner, the drinker, everybody. Wine's always been sold like that.
Yeah.
Cheese somewhat too. And now, you know, food is sold like that in the better restaurants. And, you know, getting fresh strawberries is something that matters to, you know, not just Edzo's, but I'm sure a lot of their customers.
Right.
We can plug Green City Market if you want to shop to buy direct from local farmers. You can go to Green City Market in Lincoln Park.
Is that the best of all the markets around?
The Evanston Farmers Market has most of the same vendors as Green City without the parking accesses. So.
But they don't have the zoo.
Green City has third-party certification and direct contact with the farmers. So I absolutely advocate that you should go
there. What does that mean? What is third-party certification?
Third-party certification means that they are vetted to do what they say, that they are growing things naturally.
So it's not the guy. I've always suspected at farmers markets that it's really the guy goes to the wholesale place, puts it on, puts like a tree around it, and then all of
not at our market. No.
You can tell the difference in the stuff that you buy at the farmers market, though. I mean, I'm always like, I heard someone on another radio station. It was a sports talk thing, and he was going on about how all eggs are the same, and I'm like, they really are not. If you think that, you haven't had good
sense. We have a farm in Michigan.
I only buy farmers market eggs.
When you pick eggs in the morning from chickens who are out eating bugs, you know, probably the same crickets that are in this bar. they're delicious. You know, the richness of the yolk is unbelievable.
Yeah. You can just see it, the color of the yolk.
Yeah, you can see it.
So much darker.
Taste it.
So, Greg, if you're up in Fenville, Michigan right now, what is happening with the production of apple cider? Where are you? There's no fruit yet. So
no, we're kind of clearing out the stores from the last harvest, 2017 harvest. And I was going to say, though, when Sarah mentioned Green City Market, that was really my inspiration to start Virtue, because I'd go to the Green City Market on Wednesdays and Saturdays, but more often Wednesdays, and I'd see Sarah and all these chefs there buying produce directly from the vendor, you know, from the person who grows it, which I thought was so cool. And when I was a brewer at Goose Island, you know, there was no, like, you know, hop market in Lincoln Park that I could go buy hops from.
Where do you buy hops from?
Well, when you buy hops, if you're small, you're buying them typically from a broker who's buying them from a processor who's buying them from the farm. If you're bigger, you know, Goose Island got bigger, and I got to go out to select hops in Yakima Valley and in Washington, which is also happens to be the biggest apple growing area in the country.
So you can't grow, excuse my ignorance on this, everybody, but you can't grow hops in the Midwest.
You can. Michigan's got a lot of hops now. Illinois's got a little bit. Wisconsin's got a little bit. But, you know, it's not the same as like going and seeing the producer, you know, kind of like every week. And as a cider maker, I get to do that. When I'm up in Fenville, I'll go to, you know, the post office, and I'll run into one of the farmers, you know, and I'll you know, certainly stop by the farm. They'll stop by our farm. So we're all very tight knit up there.
You have all these single orchard ciders that you could buy. So Fenville is a little bit west of Saugatuck.
That's right.
And when you drive, so it's about 2.5 hours from here. And if you just happen to be there, you can buy all these ciders that you can't get at Binny's or something like that. And a lot of them are single orchard ones. And each one I've had has a slightly different sort of characteristic to it, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the plug on that, Mark. But the single orchard ones.
Okay. Are these alcoholic or not?
Yes, absolutely.
Everyone's alcoholic.
Absolutely.
Talk about the rosé cider.
Yeah. Well, first I'm going to mention like Peter Klein, who is
Seedlings
Fruit. He's about 7 miles away from us, and we get a lot of apples from him, and that's one of the exciting orchard blends that we do. So we get his apples, we bring them in, we press them, you know, run a field apples, whatever he's got, and then we let the juice ferment on its own. Mm. So with the yeast that came in on the apples, so it's the truest expression of his fruit.
Okay, well, pour yourself a glass of cider, everybody, and we'll be right back in just a sec. Welcome back to The Download. I'm Chris Jones with my friend Mark Caro.
Hello.
We're in here for Justin Kaufman. We're here all the way through 11 o'clock on this hot Memorial Day evening. We've got Mo Ryan coming in on the 9 o'clock hour to talk about television. Then the 10 o'clock hour, we're going to be looking ahead to a comedy festival with some comedians from the Second City. So if you're on a long drive back from your nice Memorial Day weekend, maybe you've been hanging out near some of these lovely Michigan farms and all these other great places where our restaurateurs find all this great produce and that kind of thing.
And we just tried Korean kimchi barbecue flavored small batch pork rinds fried in sunflower oil. Those are your favorite of the ones we've
had
so far.
That was the winner.
Yeah, that was
all right.
Yeah,
so that's Sarah Stegner, of the chef owner of Prairie Grass Cafe in Northbrook, Eddie Lakin of Edzo's Burger Shop, and Greg Hall, the maestro of Virtue Cider and Goose Island beer. What'd you think? What did you think of the stuff we just tried just now?
I could eat the cricket bars, but I figure like half the bars out there already have crickets in them.
There you go.
So
this, they're just being honest. But yeah, this is stuff just to catch you up. Chris Jones and I went to the Sweets and Snacks Expo at McCormick Place. So we're trying a lot of different kinds of chips. A lot of like it's like not potato chips. So
pork rinds were the best though by far.
The kimchi pork rinds.
That's no, the there's no crickets in cider. You've never made a cricket flavored cider, or
we've not. We've not. But as Sarah mentioned, the rosé that we make is really fun. It's kind of rosé's taken over the world. It seems like.
Yes.
This spring.
You can have a rosé cider?
Yeah. So we did our first one with actually cherries from Peter's Farm seedlings about four
if
years ago.
If you know
ago.
Greg Hall, you can have a rosé cider.
is it rare? Like, is it? And I'm just going to come out. I've never heard of a rosé cider.
It's really
before, right
it's,
now.
It's a 2018 thing.
Is it really?
So we've been making it and selling it just in small batches on our farm for about 4 years, but now we changed to using botanicals, so we get some nice strawberry and watermelon character.
Wow.
It's floral. It's really nice.
I think the rosé I had at the farm was like from the same as those creek cherries, where like your fancy imported cherry. He gave me this whole
Charbique cherries.
Exactly, the Charbiques.
Peter Klein grows for us. So,
you know, we're talking about the future of things. So, is cider hot? Like, is cider on the rise? Because, you know, as a native Brit, cider was always something that people in this country never really seem to drink that much of, at least alcoholic cider or hard cider.
Yeah, you're right. There was a tradition 100 years ago, before Prohibition, cider was probably the most popular drink in America, but it was all homemade. When we were a much more rural land and 70% of the people worked on farms, everybody made their own cider. So that's what they drank. And recently, we have not had a big cider market in the States, but it's growing very fast. It's actually growing faster than craft beer or anything right now. And there's never been a reason why it wouldn't work,
right?
Because over in England, you know, it's about 17% of the beer market, and it's big in France and Spain and Germany and Italy and down in South America, Australia, South Africa. Everybody's got cider except us. You know, when I started Virtue, you'd go into a place like Binny's and they'd have, you know, 1,000 beers, 5,000 wines, 1,000 whiskeys, and 3 ciders. You know, they had more flavors of cocktail onions than they did cider.
No, and I would always go look for the ciders because I was into the cider. And I remember having Crispin for the first time and thinking, oh, this isn't that really sweet woodchucky stuff. And it reminded me more of what I'd had when I was in England years ago. And I thought, boy, this would. And when I'd heard that you were doing this with Virtue, I remember talking to a certain colleague of mine at the Tribune. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be really big. That's a great idea. That's a really smart thing. And I don't know if he bought into it as much as I did. And he's the one who's writing the article. But I was right. And you're happy about it, I'm sure. So there you go.
Yeah, it's been a nice transition from beer to cider. Still love beer. But cider's pretty cool when you get to, you know, go out and pick the apples yourself.
So we spent time at the beginning of this hour, like we sort of said what we'd heard was the future of restaurants. What do you think? Like, what would you say, Sarah? What's your view? Like, you know, what's going to change?
I still think that it's about community and it's about connecting. That we need that, especially. I think right here in this country that we don't have time to talk to our families and to take that break and to do that where you're nurturing yourself and eating food that you know is good, not just in flavor, but what it does for you. I just don't think anything can be better for us than that. And that will be, you know, the repeated trend.
Eddie, do you agree?
Yeah, I like what Greg said about provenance too. I think that the new quality is knowing where stuff came from and how it was treated at every step of the process. So not just where the beef was grown or raised, but how it was processed, and then how the cook treated the beef, and how the bun was baked, and every step of the way, knowing as much as you can about that process, so that not only does it taste good, but you can feel good about what went into bringing that food to your plate.
One of the other ways that technology enters into things is like all the different systems now, point of sale. And one of the things we saw was a presentation about pain by face. Where you're going to use your face as a facial recognition. And then there's all sorts of statistics about
not using Edzo's.
Apple Pay and stuff like that.
You'll get mad.
Are these important issues, being able to pay by face or use Apple Pay or any of that stuff? Or is that all kind of ancillary to what the real experience is?
We had a person ask if they could use the Samsung Pay not too long ago.
It was like, boo!
I said, I don't have that. And the guy said, no, I just have to hold my phone up to the swiper. So he did it, and it crashed my computer system. So now I say no, that no one's allowed to use those
anymore. Put your phones away at Edzo's.
So we got a call from the 815 saying, my friend is growing hops outside of Atlanta, Illinois, just this side of Springfield. Did you know that?
I did not know that his friend was doing that.
you got to go down to Springfield and check out the hops.
Do hops differ from terroir to terroir?
No, it's funny because when I was a young brewer, we'd do a recipe based on the hop variety. And, we'd like put Cascades in this and Mount Hoods in that and Centennials in the IPA. And then when I went out to Washington to select the first time, they're like, okay, we've got 37 different Cascades for you to rub and smell and taste. And I'm like, oh, they're all different. I didn't know they were all different. It's like they're all different. Of course they are. Why wouldn't they be? It's a natural carbon-based product that's grown on a farm, and some farms, get more light or get more wind or get more rain or get more pests. They're all a little bit different, have different soil, come out of the ground earlier or later. So all those things go into it. And that's exactly what we've been talking about. Knowing where stuff comes from really matters now, because there is such a difference.
And I think that human connection, my friend Tracy Vall from Three Sisters Garden, when she harvests just at the right time and delivers that product, it tastes amazing. We got the spring green onions in, and they were like heaven. I mean, they were perfect. They weren't chewy. They were just perfect. And I know it wasn't just the quality of the seeds, but it was how she treated it from beginning to end. And then in my restaurant, how I handled it.
What's great about restaurants like Sarah's is you go from like ramp season to strawberry season, to other fruits and greens, and it goes through. She can't have the same menu all the time.
It's seasonally driven.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll just hang on a sec. We'll be right back just after these messages. Well, I just want to say thanks to all three of you guys, Sarah, Greg, Eddie. Thank you for coming in, joining us on the download. Good luck with everything.
Thanks for having me.
And be sure to go to Edzo's here. Burger Shop with Eddie Lakin and Progress Cafe with Sarah Stegner in Northbrook, and drink Virtue Cider because it's really delicious. Greg Hall, thank you also for coming in. Welcome back to the download. It's Mark Caro here with Chris Jones.
Hey, everybody.
We're filling in for Justin Kaufman, and we've got people outside, people walking out, people walking around on Michigan Avenue. Hello, everyone. It is a fantastic summer day to be
in Chicago.
Baby. It's hot.
It's hot.
It's hot outside the studio, and inside the studio, we're hot, and yet we're cool. And we've got a little Trip Tower reunion going on with our good friend, Mo Ryan. Or do you go by Mo or Maureen these days?
I go by Baroness Von Ryan.
Baroness Von Ryan.
She's classed it up since we knew her. We knew her back in her lower rent days.
Yeah, I was a mere, esquire at the time. So,
All three of us at some point were the number two in our field critics at the Tribune. And two of the three of us moved up to number one.
That's a really distinguished memory.
I'm having a psychological spiral now, so thank you for that.
I'm the one who should. But anyway, so Mo is one of the, she has been just one of the great writers of television in, you know, recent years, very ahead of her time in the way she wrote about television for the Tribune and then at the Huffington Post and at Variety, where instead of just doing the thing that TV critics used to do, where you would just sort of get the new show and you would write about it and then you'd write about the next new show and then you review maybe the new TV movie, she really saw seasons as an arc of something to experience and something you can come back to, and really saw the art in what was going on television before a lot of people did, and also find the audience for that before a lot of people did. And so, like, her numbers when she was doing blogs at the Tribune were crazy high, and it's just been very popular on Twitter. You can follow her at Mo Ryan at Mo Ryan.
You know, and she, if you were doing the history of critics on social media, and I'm not, this is really true, that the early adopter, Mo Ryan. I mean, one of the first critics to really embrace, because it's always hard for critics. We don't really like social media some of the time. But Mo Ryan, early adopter, ahead of the curve.
That was said by Chris Jones, who is at Chris Jones Trib on Twitter. And this
That's
at Mark Caro, M-A-R-K-C-A-R. No, because, you know, there are other people who are better at promoting the social and stuff. But at Mo Ryan, you have more followers.
So you just understand the future better than us? How do you pull this off?
She's a futurist.
I have a crystal ball and I know everything that's happening. No, I mean, it was always for me. And honestly, even when I was at the Tribune and even before, it's always been completely bananas to me how much freedom people gave me to just kind of like do my thing. And I think a lot of employers will do that, especially if it's like there's no extra pay involved. So like, would you want to start a blog? Okay. Like, they're not going to stop you. So, you know, for a while there,
they do stop you sometimes, though.
Once in a while.
They stop me.
But I mean, I think, you know, when I was sort of, I can remember actually back at the earliest day, like in the early aughts, when it was like, you know, should we form a committee to see whether Mo can have a TV blog? And it just, finally, I remember, I think it was Jeff,
Brown?
Jeff Brown, who just said, Just go ahead and start it. And I just kind of did. So,
What is this? Here's an interesting thing. The business of recaps. A lot of people do recaps. A, so I have two questions. One, do you like recaps? And B, when did they start? When were they? Did you do that?
That was more like there were people I follow. Like, so when I joined the Tribune, I was already writing about TV to some degree because I'd been working for magazines and pop culture publications and freelancing and all that stuff. So I was reading, a really influential site was called Mighty Big TV at first and then Television Without Pity.
Right.
And I used to read Television Without Pity.
Yeah. I mean, someone did an article a few years ago just kind of like tracing the lineage of many people.
I wrote that for the Tribune. I interviewed you for it, and it was fun because I got to interview you.
Yes,
It was recaps versus reviews, and what does it mean for critical?
But there was another piece that I remember. I don't know if it was a Vulture or somebody did a piece of like, you know, all the different people that kind of came from those message boards and stuff.
Right, yeah.
So I was following other critics, and I would actually say that the peak of like kind of recap culture was around, I want to say, like maybe the early to mid aughts to about 2011-12, and it's really, I mean, for me, the form, I can review a single episode, and I can enjoy that, but I would say that in the main, I don't enjoy it. I definitely felt like I had to do it with something like Mad Men.
Was that the most recap show?
Yeah, I would say Mad Men and Breaking Bad.
The Sopranos, maybe, a little bit?
I would but that was a little bit earlier. Yeah, I would say, like, just after The Sopranos, that's when it was, like, I remember, you know, doing a weekly recap of certain shows where it can actually be nothing against the show to say that not every show can take the weight of that.
Right.
Well, and also, like, I think I just kind of got, I judge no one who does it. I personally would rather like have that as a small slice of what I do. Like, I'm going to write about this performance, or I'm going to review this show, or I'm going to write about this trend or this whole season, or maybe this episode. So I think it was kind of like for a while there, to me, it became like almost too dominant, and we became so used to it because it was like, somebody explained to me what happened on Lost last night, you know, because you would sort of dump your feelings out, your reactions out. Now I don't know that that's as big of a influence.
Part of what I found fascinating about recaps is that so much of it are read by people who had watched the show. So it really wasn't about, you know, I mean, it was something like Lost is like unlock secrets, make me think differently about it. But it wasn't like, here, get me up to speed on this. It was really like, I sort of want to re-experience this in a different way. I want this person to write me through it. And the bad recaps, if you could call them good and bad, are the ones that really just rehash the plot, like sort of the old soap opera digest things you read in the Saturday paper. What happened on the soaps this week? But the good ones are the ones that kind of dig into it and find something new to write about. But it's true that like sometimes after a while you're like, okay, it's a little more than I need about that particular.
And also the way we're consuming media is so different. I mean, if you watched all of Orange is the New Black season 4 the day it came out, and it took me 2 years to, I mean, we're kind of so all over the map that, I mean, you know, it's funny, like talking about like when I was writing about TV at the Tribune and how I got into this or did that or social media. It's always to me like what seems like a fun thing to do. Sometimes, as you know, both of you, sometimes the fun thing to do is to like write a rant or write a, a negative review. Or, you know, it's the fun thing is to just delve into one aspect of some work or some piece that you're interested in. So it's really, to me, like following what's interesting. So that can definitely be really, really hard, because when I was at the Tribune, probably starting out watching TV and writing about it critically, there were maybe 70 or 80 scripted shows in the country. Now there's 500.
Yeah, wow, that's a huge change.
Yeah, there was that sense of, oh, reality TV is going to kill scripted television.
Like, yeah, so that right happened, now. Definitely.
So, all right, we're talking to Mo Ryan, the wonderful TV writer, critic, 312-981-7200. If you'd like to talk to her as well, if you want to send a text, and we will be right back after this break. Welcome back to The Download. Filling in for Justin Kaufman, it's Mark Caro and my good friend, Chris Jones. And the happy waving guy outside, hello.
Hi, waving guy.
And there's Maureen Ryan, another good friend. It's Maureen, just like a reunion here. Mo Ryan. We're so happy. Mo is trying some of our sweets and snacks right now. What are you trying there?
I'm having some kind of quinoa something that's just actually tasty. Quinoa tomato chips of some kind.
Yeah, what's the company on that?
It's Snats.
Yeah, it's S-N-A-T-T-S. And I want to say, oh, Snats. Seems like a false name. Quinoa, but it's very good. That's actually quinoa.
Doesn't that seem like the kind of made-up name that would be on a TV show? Because they didn't want to actually use the real brand. There's also some pork rinds happening, a Korean kimchi flavor, so I'm feeling good.
You like
good.
That? That was the favorite of our last panel. Yeah. Okay, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. So we wanted to talk to you about this New York Times documentary that we're watching. Yeah. But actually, you know what? We got a couple calls. Let's take a couple of these calls because we want to hear. There's one from Kathy. Can we put Kathy on the air? Let's do that. Hello, Kathy.
Hey.
Can you hear her? I cannot.
Yeah, I have a question for Mo. By the way, I enjoyed your interview with Tom Lorenzo.
Thank you. Oh.
You're welcome. So if it were the last days of the world and you had to retreat to a desert island, what television series would you take with you and why?
So you're saying we're not in the end game of humanity? So I already
Do you already
like
have your stockpile of your DVDs?
I have. That's such a good question. I think I would take shows that would make me think and make me cry, you know, things that I could watch over and over again. I feel like I could watch The Leftovers 100 times, Parks and Recreation, Jane the Virgin. I mean, you probably, you know, if you follow me at all, you probably know what my obsessions are. So, I mean, something like Breaking Bad, just for the sheer achievement of it. But also, like, I would need things to, like, kind of, like, just make me feel good about the remaining, you know, humanity, which I guess will be me only at that point, which, you know.
Humanity does not have a great future once you go.
I mean, there's so many half hours, too, that, I mean, I think I would just, if I could take all of, like, BoJack Horseman, it would make me feel like, it would make me laugh out loud and feel deeply for, you know, the human species at the same time.
Chris, what would you take?
The greatest TV show.
What would you take with you at the end of the world if you could only take one thing with you to watch?
Six Feet Under, no question.
6 feet under.
I actually have a couple British things that I might consider. The Singing Detective, which is only a six-part thing. Yeah. Dennis Potter, yeah. Michael Gambon, which blew me away at the time. And, you know, I might just take Monty Python, too. Just
yeah,
to, just,
that'd be
just
a great
to,
one.
You know, because that's so dark anyway. It kind of has apocalyptic, but very funny.
I've watched some of those episodes. I mean, there was a time back when we were youths when MTV would rerun Monty Python, like, you know, every night, and I just watched it. Like, I think there's episodes I've seen, and I also had like the cassette tape, so I probably, you know, some routines I might probably heard like 1,000 times. So if they're still funny 1,000 times later, then, you know, it's probably a good piece of art.
All right. Well, thanks for calling, Kathy.
Thank you, Kathy.
So you just had a review in the New York Times of The Fourth Estate.
Yeah.
Which we, Chris and I watched the premiere episode that was on last night, although they put the rest of them up on demand already.
Yeah.
So I've not gone through. Chris and I have some thoughts about
this.
Yeah,
please. I want to know what you think, because I sort of watched
all right,
it.
All right, I'm just going to throw this out, because I didn't like it. I've only watched the preview edition. Which did you base your review on that one?
I saw all four, I'd love to.
Okay,
I mean,
what we're talking about is it's a fly on the wall. The New York Times, right after it starts the day that Trump is inaugurated, and they've just got cameras following them all this time. And Dean Baquet, who's the editor of the New York Times, you see him watching the Trump, you know, carnage inaugural speech and going, "This is such a great story. It's such an epic," and it's sort of like this weird kind of fake news version of real documentary. It's like a postmodern sort of thing almost. It's like, because you realize that they're doing all this stuff in front of cameras, and that, Chris, what do you think?
Well, I have some ethical issues with it, in the sense that I think when journalists start trying to be the story, it is often problematic. And I don't think that the New York Times' public service image is especially well served by that show, because what you see is you see the dirty business of you know, putting news in a paper. You see everyone's personal sort of perceptions that come out. And I recognize that on some levels that's interesting. And I also recognize that if people don't get the chance to see it, they don't do anything. They don't know about it, and therefore they don't value it. So I totally, with all due respect for that, because I really do believe that, but I just find it, a little, I guess I feel a bit like you can be one or the other. You can be either working on the story. There's moments there where you feel like they're performing for the camera for me. I don't think we need to know everyone's perceptions. And I think I found it a little self-serving on the part of the New York Times.
I think they're in a really strange position. And I have so many complex feelings about the New York Times, which, you know, I guess in some way I'm sort of, you know, I'm freelancing for them. So, but I feel about the New York Times, and I feel about that documentary the way that I kind of feel about, you know, television criticism in general, or a criticism, I guess, which we've all done for a long time, which is that you can love something and still deeply critique it. And I think the problem for me with that documentary is that if you know anything about how newspaper reporters work, you know that there's a huge chunk that you're not seeing in that documentary.
Right.
Because
right.
Between Dean Baquet and a reporter, even a experienced good reporter in D.C. or New York, there's many layers of people.
Right.
And you almost never see those layers. So
because the story is either Dean Baquet or the reporter.
And so I feel like
that's right.
And also the thing is, people who are, I think that Liz Garbus, who's the filmmaker, I've liked other of her films a great deal. And I'm just mixed on this. So I'm not saying don't watch it. I would just say the New York Times clearly wants people to value what they do. And I understand in this day and age of like media instability, why they would want that. I think it's a tough thing for the New York Times in particular, because they've for decades, if not forever, had this very lofty ivory tower. Like we here in the New York Times will dispense the news from our golden chalice of news gathering. And it's like,
well, you know, there's that scene where Baquet says in the olden days, something happened at 10 in the morning. The New York Times was not expected to have anything to say until the following morning. Right. And you go, whoa, that was true. Not that long ago. We were all working then. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well, I joined the Tribune in 1997 and kind of was that way too. Yeah. It's a weird, I think that, you know, in the press notes for the documentary, Liz Garbus said, I sat there the day after Trump was elected and I just was tearing my hair out at my desk. What do I do? And she said, well, what I can do is demystify one of the great journalism institutions of all time and see how they work. But I think, you know, as you and I both know, as all three of us know, most reporters are somewhat uncomfortable being the story.
Yes,
and
as we should be.
As I think so. I mean, I never got the sense that anyone was trying to, like, showboat necessarily for the cameras. But I think that a lot of how I work anymore, and I don't know, I can't speak for you, but it's like email and Slack and texts.
Right.
So the way a story is actually shaped and put together, they don't really dwell on one story or one person or one particular day.
I would have liked to see them
do. It just feels like it skitters around a bit for me.
It almost feels like it would have been better served if you just had like one story and how it was, you know, like there's the one thing in the premiere episode where they're working on the story, they don't have it, and then the Post gets the transcript of that they were going after, and so the Post just scoops them and they get it. But it's almost like you could have spent the entire episode just seeing the reporting of the thing that they get scooped on, and you would have felt something. But it's true, there are so many quote unquote characters and it's going in so many places that you're really not getting attached to any of them, and so then you get to the point where you're like, why am I watching the Washington bureau chief put away her sudsy cutting board, and why didn't she rinse it first? But why are we watching that? Why are we watching this guy make espresso for his fellow reporter and talk about like the coffee he likes? Because it's there to sort of pretend like, okay, he's a character because he likes coffee. But I'm like,
It's trying to do so much. And I think I kind of feel like you. At one point I had a line in the review that I cut at one point or another, that it should have either been much shorter or much longer.
Or maybe at a different point in history so that you don't feel like you've just watched all this new. You know, I was actually, my wife said this to me, like, it's too soon, maybe.
Right.
There's no perspective on anything.
Maybe. Although I will say, in its defense, I really thought the fourth episode was kind. Okay. There were parts of it that were good. There are parts of it throughout that feel too much like a PR film that you would see at a company retreat.
Yes.
You know, but I think the fourth episode, they really follow a couple stories much more.
Is that the one that deals with Glenn Frush?
Yeah, it does.
We should talk about that again.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about that. We're going to come back. We got to go to commercial break right now. We're here with Mo Ryan and Chris Jones and Mark Caro on The Download. Welcome back to The Download. This is Mark Caro with my friend Chris Jones. We are filling in for Justin Kaufman. Say hello, Chris.
How you doing, everybody? Welcome back to The Download. An hour and 30 minutes to go, but we got Mo Ryan.
We got Mo Ryan here, who we've known as a TV critic and friend for a long time at the Chicago Tribune, most recently at Variety, and in the New York Times. She reviewed the documentary on Showtime about the New York Times, and we'll also talk to her about some other TV stuff, like season finales and maybe some of the Me Too controversy going on. So you end your lead, the first paragraph, saying, when both the film and the publication are on their A game, they're quite good and occasionally gripping. So in your review of this doc about the New York Times, you're sort of calling out the New York Times for not always being on its A game. Did they give you any specific instructions? Like, did they say, okay, we need you to review this and don't worry, we can take it?
They just gave me a word count. Nothing at all. I thought it was actually really admirable that I do think that there are gaps in like what the documentary does, but when things got very awkward and difficult, the cameras did not get turned off. I mean, there are certain moments especially in the fourth episode where the cameras don't follow people in the offices, but there was a situation with one of their star DC reporters, Glenn Thrush, and there are some conference calls you know, including high level people and including, you know, DC bureau people, where the situation is discussed, and, you know, people are sort of ashen faced. They're very upset, but they allow the cameras to stay. And if you don't, if you're not aware, there was a story in Vox making allegations about Glenn Thrush's conduct with women. The New York Times placed him on leave for 2 months. They did their own investigation. At the conclusion of that, it was decided that he would be reassigned and still remain an employee. So,
obviously that was that was tricky for them, because they've been on the sort of forefront of the Me Too reporting for other organizations. Yeah. So when then they had a situation where it's one of their own. So arguably they should have. I mean, the argument that some people made, right, Mo, was that they didn't do what they'd essentially expected others to do in some ways.
Well, I think that. I think if there's anything that you learn from what we've all gone through since, you know, October of last year, many different realms of the media industries have been exposed as, you know, essentially enabling predators or, you know, bad behavior. Mm. But especially in the news media. And I don't necessarily, how do I put it? A number of men who cover politics were found out to, or had important roles in news organizations were found to have allegedly or actually acted inappropriately. Many left their jobs. Many, you know, I mean, the highest profiler, like, say, Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose, that kind of thing.
Right, right.
But if you were to compile a list of Mark Halperin, who was probably the most important political reporter in America at that time. So, I think there's a lot of troubling things to think about. And I would have, you know, I'm sure that when those revelations began dropping at the New York Times, many people had the thought, just based on percentages, there's got to be something here. And it came out.
Do you
out.
Attribute that to something about the news business that creates that atmosphere? Is there something about that culture? Or do you just say it's just like any other industry?
Right.
This is part of any other industry.
I think, you know, and actually there's really good research on this. The EEOC, if you look on their website, there's actually a really good 2016 study. You can look for it in their publications. It's very easy to find. It's about what are the conditions in which harassment and abuse of power are endemic? Where, like, what are the conditions? And this has been proven by studies after study. If there are industries in which there are vast differentials in power, it's not just that. So abuse and harassment happens everywhere, right? But where will it be not only tolerated, but actively enabled? If you are telling me that, you know, there are many allegations regarding Matt Lauer, if the story of the corporation is that no one in management knew, I personally, speaking only for myself, Maureen Ryan, I find that difficult to believe.
Right.
So I think that, you know, a lot of people have said, oh, well, Wall Street. Yeah, absolutely. Wall Street's like that. But what other industry? I would say the news media for sure, and the Hollywood entertainment industry for sure. There are 14 to 16 hour days in which someone who's worth $20 million is working alongside someone making $10, $15, maybe an hour.
Right.
So the abuse of power, like, I find that, yes, there are many wealthy, powerful people in the world. How many of them are around a ton of, you know, people who are high up in the news media industries, just to get an internship there is incredibly competitive.
Yeah.
So people will do anything to honestly not get anyone in trouble.
And I suppose those guys they are sort of the face of the news. So they're powerful in their bosses' eyes. They may have bosses.
Yeah,
they do have bosses. But they nonetheless they have more power than their bosses.
Absolutely.
Most cases.
Yeah, right. They're huge. Yeah, huge, powerful. Power bases, I should say.
So if you want to call in, we're talking to Mo Ryan. It's Mark Caro and Chris Jones on the download. Maureen Ryan, wonderful TV critic. We're talking about The Fourth Estate and other things in television. 312-981-7200. You may text us, you may call us, and we have a call right now from George. Hello, George.
Hey, how's it going tonight?
Great.
Hey,
how are you?
Hi. Hey, George.
I'm doing all right. I have a really weird question that has nothing to do with anything that you just mentioned.
That's all right.
I want to know, as somebody who doesn't have any tattoos but is looking to get one, what was the inspiration for your arm tattoos? You have some really, really cool ones on your arm. So what was your inspiration?
How do you know this? Are you watching or are you watching his arm?
She's standing outside.
Are you standing outside? Are you watching his on the wall?
No, I posted photos.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Anybody who's a fan of Maureen should know that she has two awesome arm sleeves.
Right. I do, and I have a back piece as well. They're all on my, I think the back piece is on my Instagram. Thank you for that cool question. I would say I feel very lucky for, it was someone here in Chicago, Pioneer Studio, which is an appointment only place. A friend of mine put me in touch with Harlan Thompson, who works out of there. And he's, what I like about Harlan is that, and I think that this is an experience many of my friends have had too. You know, the first tattoo that he did, I brought photos. I had a talk. I think you can absolutely walk into a street shop and see something that you like. I never did. So for me, I would say think really hard about what you want. And if you're lucky, you may come into contact with an artist who maybe you can have the first thing, the first meeting that you have is a conversation. And with Harlan, I brought in photos for my first couple and was like, these are my ideas. And then he went away and created the art. And then for the back piece, we just talked about like two or three things. And he just is, when I get my tattoo work done, I have to stare at his sketchboard. So I know his work so well. I was like, okay, this, and this. What do you think? And he's like, yeah, what about this? And then it was like a 10-minute conversation, and he just knew what to do. I went in and for my first appointment, and it was like sketched out there, and then we just went from that.
So you were not in your 20s when you got your first tattoo.
No, I was an
old
person.
So this was a conscious thing you did later. What was the thing that inspired you? Said, all right, now I'm going to do the tattoos.
I was going through a really, really hard time. I think that this is something that I've heard from a lot of people, that when you are in a tough place mentally and emotionally, I know of a lot of veterans who get inked to commemorate friends. And I think to me, it's a way to manifest something internally, externally. And I got my first very small tattoo, which is the letters BHN for Be Here Now. Although my friend Alan Sepinwall looked at that and he said, does that stand for Beverly Hills Ninja? And I'm like, well, it does now. That was right before my father died. That was a hard year. And then getting tattoos was a form of self-care. I have a lot of nature-derived art. And the winter after my dad died in 2013 was that horrible winter here in Chicago, right, where the snow was like 4 feet tall all the time. Yeah. And it was a way to get out of my head, to get out of, you know, to just put something beautiful on my body back into the world. It's weird. I never expected to be this person with this much extensive ink, but life is interesting, right? Yeah. So, George, I thank you for the question, and that was a really good one.
Thank you so much for answering. I really appreciate it. That was awesome.
My pleasure.
Thanks a lot, George. We're talking TV and tattoos with Maureen Ryan. And we will be right back after this. It's over. It's all over. Welcome back
downbeat music.
No, you can listen.
Is this your way of telling me to get lost?
Yeah, it's over. It's over. Get rid of Mo Ryan.
All right.
No, this is actually the sort of chirpy theme song of what happens when to your career when you don't treat people right.
Yes. You'd think.
It's Mark Caro and Chris Jones back on The Download on WGN Radio. We're here with Mo Ryan, TV critic extraordinaire. We were discussing television and a little bit of the Me Too movement.
Yeah.
You've studied this pretty well. I mean, this mm-hmm. past week we've had Morgan Freeman mm-hmm. going on, and now they're talking about taking away his Screen Actors Guild Lifetime Achievement Awards. Harvey Weinstein in cuffs. What's happening?
Three sets of cuffs.
I could watch that on a permanent loop forever.
by another Tribune ex-Tribune person, Megan Toohey, who won a Pulitzer Prize from the New York Times.
Much,
Jody Cantor.
Very deserved. I think so. I have done some Me Too stories. I've talked about my own experience that actually opened the floodgates to many people contacting me, which is something that was really, I felt very honored by that. And I also think that something I don't talk about a lot, but maybe I should, is that I have talked to, I would say, probably a couple hundred people about these. I mean, certain, obviously I talk to people in the industry. We all talk about, like, are things changing? Will things change? All that kind of stuff. But I've also kind of tried to serve as a sounding board for people who don't know if they want to come forward or think they want
to. These are people working in the TV industry.
Yeah. And so there's a bar that has to be met. And I think that it's funny because I can tie this back into the Fourth Estate. Because we don't like to make ourselves the story, I don't think that a lot of people who are doing stories in this area talk about all the near misses. I've done I've contributed to others, but like I've done two big Me Too stories. Having talked to many more people than that, I can tell you there are a number of people who their story, for whatever reason, does not pass pass a certain bar. And believe me, I try to connect them to resources, and I try to just feel like, it, you know, listening to their story, maybe there's something people have told me that that's helpful. You know,
so in other words, when you hear someone's story about that, there's often six other stories that you're not hearing at the same
minimum. Yeah. Right, I have like most people I know who work in entertainment journalism who have an interest in this area, who have done stories in this area. We all have spreadsheets. Because the thing is, a lot of times someone doesn't become a sort of a person of interest, if you will, until there's a critical mass of people saying this person. So I'm still monitoring, you know, some people don't want to use their name or don't want to, you know, we don't necessarily have enough proof or something could change. But I think it really makes me very agitated when people are like, well, has Me Too gone too far? And I sit there and I think about the stories that I've heard about people being incredibly cautious about their reporting. I think that I cannot myself personally point to reporting from credible sources that has turned out to be 100% untrue. There's a recent case with George Takei where some facts, I think, were altered or were walked back.
Yeah, he was on our show.
Not about that, but yeah.
So I think when people see a story of that nature in a reputable publication, they should think that there were probably teams of lawyers going over that story many times.
Are there all sorts of people who you know about who you're thinking, all right, the other shoe's going to drop for this person, and this person at some point?
I hope so. Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, I'm not going to ask you what they are on there, but.
Yeah, there are. There are people who I think, and I mean, sometimes this has been a phenomenon that's happened a fair bit where, you know, someone floats a trial balloon of like maybe their career is going to come back, and then that prompts people to come out of
quite often
what you see is one story prompts another wave of stories. So I think the thing that I'm concerned about right now more than anything is if you are a PA or an assistant on a film or TV set today, what additional institutional resources do you have that you didn't have a year ago? And I'm not talking about HR, because corporate HR in Hollywood is pretty much worthless. And I'm not talking about individuals acting morally and believing you, which I think is a thing that does happen. Institutionally speaking, there's Time's Up, that foundation. There are phone numbers you can call now. But I'm going to be out in LA and traveling and talking to people again. I really think that there's definitely a sense that people are more aware, and there's more of awareness of consequences. But has the awareness of consequences and have the curbs on abuses of power by institutions, formally and informally, are those curbs truly there? I will let you judge from this story. I reported on a show called Brad Kern, who had two HR investigations in 1 year. And this is with people in Hollywood knowing that HR is not really usually their friend. And so my story came out talking about not just his behavior.
This is in Variety.
Mm-hmm. Came out last December. CBS did nothing. And I had sources that said that the behavior was ongoing. They not only did nothing, He has stepped down as of the end of the season of the show as showrunner, but I don't actually know what that means. He's going to be a consultant. His contract was set to run out. Why not just let it run out? Mm. So if he's just going to be a consultant and not all that involved, essentially what he's got is what a lot of very high-profile men have gotten, which is a paid vacation. And I know of women who have had severe career consequences just from the mental trauma of having been targeted and abused. Mm. So, you know, it's, I think Hollywood, I don't, tell me if you guys agree, because you've covered the, you know, entertainment industries for a long time. Hollywood's really good at helping people forget things that it does not want them to remember.
Certainly.
Well, our whole society does that right now. It's amazing. It's like you can't keep up with the scandal of everything. Like the shelf life of all this stuff is so quick right now. Mm. And so, but I do think that there's also the sense of, well, I'm the cynical, I'm just going to do the comeback. And I do think people are shooting that down. I mean, when Harvey Weinstein kept floating that, people are like, no, you don't get to do that.
You know what really weirded me out about that? When he went in holding some books, like a book about Elia Kazan, which is like, dude, no, you're not being persecuted like Elia Kazan. Right. Please take yourself off the cross, as my mom would say. But then he walked out, and he had this weird smile on his face. And to me, that was like, I am not a mental health professional, but it just seemed sociopathic. Like, he's like, I'm going to smile and show that they haven't gotten me down. It's like, what is...
There's kind of no coherent response he could have at this point, though, because he just needs to. I mean, I'm not going to...
That smile, but I definitely think that if you are sociopathic enough to, as a human being, this applies to a lot of people, to have engaged in that kind of behavior for years, then you have no self-awareness. Like, there's a lot of people, I think, who have literally no self-awareness. And so my concern going forward, this isn't the thing that gets massive clicks. This isn't, you know, like the big, you know, story which my friends at Variety did on Matt Lauer, which was incredible. But like, what institutional reforms have been made so that when the powerful abuse their power, those with less or no power have some kind of recourse and will not suffer the consequences? Yeah,
that's a great question, and obviously one worth following up diligently. We have to go to a break right now, but we will be right back with Maureen Ryan on The Download. Thanks. Well, we could talk to Mo Ryan, our friend, fellow TV critic, all evening long, but we're going to have to bid her goodbye. So thank you from Mark Caro and Chris Jones over here. Thanks for coming in so much.
Okay, my pleasure.
One last text from the 847. MASH or All in the Family?
MASH, 100%.
100%.
Movie or TV show?
TV show.
I did that as a cage match 2 weeks ago, and movie won big time. But, you know,
they're both really good, but I guess I kind of think about that. Just to bring us full circle, I think about that desert island question. It's like, if you were to give me a MASH box set, I'd be really fine on that desert island.
Just get the last few discs.
All right, thanks, Mo.
Welcome back to The Download. This is Mark Caro with my good friend Chris Jones, filling in for Dustin Kaufman. And we're here in the final hour, the home stretch.
The home stretch, baby. The home stretch.
Here we go. And we're going to bring it back with some laughs and energy and all sorts of good stuff. Chris, who do we have in the studio now?
If you're out there on that freeway hoping to get back after your partying Memorial Day weekend, we're going to keep you awake. That's what we're going to do.
And we've given them snacks, too.
Snacks. We're all fired up.
Oh, my
goodness.
Here at the Download. We got Mona Aubameyang. I said it right. Aubameyang. That's good, right?
Yeah, you did okay.
All right. That's good. It's me.
You say it.
Okay.
I want to hear you say it.
Uh-oh.
Aubameyang. Like a true Chicago.
Aubameyang.
That sounds good.
Yeah. Well, Mona Aubameyang.
And we got Mars Timms.
Mars Timms in the place to be. That is Mars like the planet, except with a Z.
You do like comedy and trivia at the same time.
Me at the Comedy Bowl, yeah.
Comedy and trivia?
Yeah, we have at the Comedy Bowl, we've got two stand-ups.
Where's the Comedy Bowl, Chicago?
Diversity River Bowl, if you're familiar. It's one of the oldest establishments in Chicago.
I know Diversity River Bowl. What do you do there?
I host. That's one of my shows I produce. I host, and it's
a very fun show.
Yeah, it is, right? Yeah, he did it recently. And we pick a random subject in terms of coming up with trivia. We've got two two comics, a trivia on a particular subject like women in sports or flamenco dancing. Mm-hmm. And then we do two more comedians, and then we do a finale of a like a lip sync contest, and we give out prizes and fun and shenanigans all on a Tuesday.
Yeah, you laugh and learn.
Right. I'm like obsessed with that HQ. Do you ever do the HQ, the thing online? You ever do that?
Not online. No.
It's an insane trivia thing where like a million people play, and there's always one question that like kills you.
Which one question? What killed you last?
What killed me last? It was about. Oh my god, what was it? Well, there was one about weird universities in Pennsylvania, like which state is not a university in Pennsylvania. So in California University, there is that university. Indiana University in Pennsylvania,
right?
IUP, right. And then Maryland, which is not the right one. So there's questions like that.
So universities that aren't in the states that they have the name for.
That say they have the name for.
Oh, so
like Miami of Ohio, like that sort of thing?
Miami of Ohio.
Yeah, I was just going to say Miami of Ohio. Yeah. Miami of Ohio is the one.
Our trivia questions are way easier. Give us
an example of one of your trivia questions.
Comedy audiences are way dumber.
Yeah. We really are.
What city are you in?
Basically, I was like,
there would be people that wouldn't get it.
What is breakdancing? You know, and I give like, is it A, B, or C? And they're like, oh, or all of the above. And thankfully, it's like all of the above because some of us are dum dums.
Yeah.
So I get you kind of like, it's like herding cats sometimes when it comes to trivia and comedy.
Do they serve alcohol at this thing?
Oh, yeah, they do. Oh, yeah. By the end of the show, they are brilliant and very happy.
Yeah, they have they like those big giant things.
Yeah,
they have like big giant tubes of beer that you can get there too. Like a whole
it's like
day.
A throng of beer.
Are there like people bowling around you while you're doing it?
Well, there's like a restaurant, and then just outside the doors, there is, yes, a full on bowling alley.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah,
you'll see like torture. It sounds
diversity
torture
bowl.
For a comedian.
It's fantastic. Yeah. It's horrific. There's been people who have been held up after their show.
Yes.
There's been people who have like.
For
their
trivia
out.
Money.
Yeah, for their trivia money, right. It's a fantastic show.
And not to toot my own horn, I am doing? Pretty good at trivia, and I have a few friends that I beat all the time at trivia. So whenever you want, Chris Jones, come
around. Where do we find you on a regular basis?
On a regular basis, I have my show, Pimprov, which is Friday nights at 10:30 at CIC Theater. Yes. Every Friday night for the past 10 years, we are in our 15th year of doing Pimprov. So you can come and check that out. It's an improvised show. It is basically about four pimps that took improv classes at Second City and decided to, hey, let's now do a show.
So this is a fictional idea. There weren't really four pimps.
No, they are not really four pimps. But when I came up with the idea, it was based upon a friend's father who was an ex-pimp. And I was like, I was like, what? Comedy is about great characters.
So what is the idea exactly?
The idea is that these four pimps, Second City used to have a training class called the Players Workshop.
Yes.
And so pimps consider themselves players. So these four pimps go to the Players Workshop thinking they're going to learn how
thinking
to be like
pimp school.
Yeah, so, they think it's pimp school. And it turns out they're improv classes. And they're like, we took these classes. Now we're pimps. We're going to make money. So they do the show instead.
All right. So what's a good pimp joke? What's one of these characters give us something they would respond to.
Well, my character is Grand Finale because ladies, after me there is no one else, and I go all the world. I am an international man. We have all sorts of aliases. We have there's a pimp named Max Strong, Prince Midas, Papa Bear. We have so many different aliases that we go by, and it's a fun show. Again, we've been doing
it for 15
years.
So how is it structured? Like the pimps just talk to each other, or what?
The first show we ever did was basically the pimps. We went out on stage, and we had our outfits on, and we just made fun of each other for 20 straight minutes, and the audience thought it was funny. But the show has evolved from there, and so now we
kind of needed to.
Yeah, we needed to. So now. Our intros are up top where we introduce the audience to who we are as characters. Then from there, we do some long form scenes. And then from there, we go down into short form scenes. And because we're pimps, we're able to break that fourth wall, go out into the audience, talk to the ladies. And again, it's all for a good cause because we donate money to domestic abuse shelters located throughout the country, wherever we perform at. So, yeah.
Well, we've been handing out these, we've been eating these snacks and sweets and snacks chips and stuff all evening, and you what would your pimp how would you react to, because you just had the kimchi pork rinds, and I want to hear you improvise some pimp humor about what you just ate.
Look, pimpin', I'm from the west side of Chicago, and the only thing I know about pork rinds is you throw hot sauce on them, but now you got these old uppity hipster pork rinds, Korean kimchi barbecue, they're fried in sunflower oil. Come on, man, who's frying pork rinds in sunflower oil, man. That's great. You got to put them with pig fat and then some hot sauce on them, Louisiana, and not these old hipster hot sauces either. I'm not talking about Tabasco sauce or Sriracha or anything like that. I'm talking straight Louisiana crystals.
Big old bucket of one.
Big old, that's right. You got to go to Aldi's to get good hot sauce.
Yeah. And on that note, we are going to go to commercial. We will be right back. And I want to hear more about what Mars and Mona are doing in the Second City show you got coming up. So we'll be right back after a break. Welcome back to The Download. It's Mark Caro here with Chris Jones. We are filling in for Justin Kaufman, winding down this long Memorial Day weekend. And we got some funny people with us.
Yeah.
Mars Timms and, all right, I'm going to get it, Mona Abermishan.
You did. Yeah, you were close.
Very That's smooth. That very yes. smooth.
Abermishan.
Abermishan.
Abermishan. So I didn't really get it. I so was wrong. I was on the one and the
polite.
Three and not the two and the
just
four.
Just being polite.
You've Abermishan. That's the way you say it is so much better anyway.
You've lived all over the world, I see.
I have, yeah.
Where? Like, where have you lived?
I've lived in Oberkirch, Germany, Berlin, Germany. I've lived in Windhoek.
What are Germans Namibia? What are Germans laugh at?
They have
sense of humor?
They laugh at us. They laugh at the fact. No, I don't want to go into that. They're very funny. Actually, you know what? The scene is thriving. There's a couple of Chicagoans here that I've worked with that are going out there, and I have relationships with them in Berlin, and the comedy scene is really coming up. And what's dope is that it's rooted in Chicago, and so it's bilingual. So the scene in Germany that's doing comedy has a root in Chicago, and it's English and German coming
up. This is stand-up you're talking about.
Stand-up comedy, and improv as well.
Oh, right. Speaking of improv, so you guys are working with the Second City on this new big comedy festival. Tell us about that. Breakout. When's that coming up?
It's coming up June 6th through 9th at Second City at the Up Comedy Club there that they have at 230 North Wells.
Right, upstairs.
Third floor.
Yeah. Yep. It's actually the fourth annual. This is the fourth time we're doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's and what are you doing? You're doing stand-up sets? Or
yes.
It's like a breakout comedy festival.
It'll be a lot of stand-up sets. There's the 6th, the Bob Curry Fellowship. They're going to be doing more sketch and improv in their show on that Wednesday to 6th.
Yeah.
Then Thursday to Saturday, those are the stand-up comedy shows.
So who is the comedian's comedian? Like, who do you guys, in that festival, who do you think is going to be the next, like, the really hot thing? Who's your
present
pick
company?
You're not allowed to pick yourself.
One of the coolest parts about being a Chicago comic is that we are the root of comedy. So again, when I've lived and performed all over the world, and when they introduce me as a Chicago comedian, and I come out as a Chicago comic. Yeah. So this festival has that roots. We've got comedians on this festival that are coming out from LA, New York, DC. We've got Godfrey hosting it. We've got a local guy, Asad Osman, and Asad performs all over the world.
David Pompey is coming back.
Yeah, Godfrey's coming. You got Chicago natives that are like
T. Murph, you have Calvin Evans, Aaron Branch, so many.
Come on, like, you're not asking about one. Who is the hot? Who do you like?
Is the ticket. You buy that ticket for that showcase.
Right. Yeah,
like, real talk. Like, I watch comedy all day. We watch comedy constantly. I can't wait.
Here's the thing.
I can't wait.
Yeah. What you're going to want to do is get yourself a ticket to every show of this festival, because you cannot go wrong.
Yeah, you remember the Rat Pack? Remember the Rat Pack?
Yes.
It was the best of the best come together, right?
Yep.
And you're like, the ticket for that would be all your greats. You get to watch them all together.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this festival is about. And you want me to sell it more than that? We can't, because can't wait.
Alex Kuman, you got Shannon Knoll. My girl Shannon Knoll is going to be there.
So you've got, black, white, purple, gay, straight, Muslim,
everything.
Non-Muslim, a Palestinian, not Palestinian. You've got every ethnicity on this lineup of the great comedians that are working throughout the country.
Stephanie Bronco.
This is like the Uber pitch. This is the greatest pitch in the history of WGN radio.
The elevator has to go two floors.
This is so much good comedy in Chicago. And you know Christian's been around here long enough doing all these shows. I mean, you got Anthony Bonazzo, Joel Boyd.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Lauren Walker.
And this is all stand-up, not improv,
this
correct?
Is stand-up.
The people that I'm naming are stand-up. I know, and a lot of us have done improv as well. Yes. So that's all the good thing about it. I know David Pompey, that's big brother.
So the MCs, the hosts are going to be epic on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And then each one of the talent is coming out. That's like, I mean, I could tell you why each one of these comedians individually I booked on my show, he's had on his show, mm-hmm. and we've seen them work throughout the country, and that they're really worth coming out and watching. It's going to be absolutely awesome. And so, NBC's there just taking notes and judging all of us, which makes it even
taking
worse.
Taking notes. I bet they're smelling the future talent.
That's right. They're going to be taking notes and writing checks. That's what I'm looking for.
Has Chicago gotten better at sort of looking at a broader group of people and saying, all right, all these people are funny, you know? And it's just like, you know, like just, I mean, you were mentioning just like the diverse crowd. Has it become better for, you know, a more diverse crowd to be discovered in Chicago than maybe, you know, 10 years ago or something like that?
Yeah. I'd say absolutely.
Absolutely. And here's the thing. Chicago is known as the Mecca for comedy.
Yes.
People come to Chicago from all over the world to learn and hone their craft. I know guys that are in New York and in LA that you can't get the stage time that you can get in Chicago. Right.
And also some of our Chicago greats, born and raised here, when they go out to LA and New York and they're working on scripts, they're contacting Chicago comics to help them write their stuff. So Chicago is not only a place where we become great and it's rooted and it's the Mecca. It's actually now, because industry's coming in with all the TV shows and all the stuff, it's actually becoming a place you don't want to leave.
Yeah.
So were you born? Did you move here, or were you born here?
I was born on Clark and Addison.
Clark and Addison
in Wrigley Field.
that's third base side.
My parents met at PETA Inn in a good old nice Jewish neighborhood like Skokie. One's Palestinian, one's English.
Your parents met Dempster. PETA Inn on Dempster?
Yep, they fell
in. You are the product of the PETA Inn.
I am falafel. I am your little falafel. Comedy is our life. And in Chicago, again, because so much industry is now coming home to Chicago, again, like you've got from Lil Rel with the Black South Side, you've got comedians coming from all over. Right. They keep the roots alive here in Chicago, so you're going
to
love to come.
Key and Peele, I mean, they came here to Chicago.
Yes, I recall them
before they went out.
Yes, they did.
Everybody comes here first.
All of the greats.
Everybody.
So a lot of you guys, you have these kind of shows that you curate, like your show at the Diversity Bowl. It's like it's a one night a week thing. Is that right?
Yep, yep.
So a lot of people are doing those shows around town at different venues.
It's beautiful because a lot of our colleagues, they go out to the coast, and one of the things they're finding is they're having difficulty having stage time.
Right.
You don't have stage time, you're not working on your craft. But here in Chicago, we've got different shows from the Pimprov to the Diversity Bowl, and I run a show. I also call it The Riff. It's an open mic where you have to show up. You get on stage. We give you the microphone, and you have to pick a suggestion, and you have to riff for 4 minutes, and it's live open mic. And I've now set up a satellite showcase in Cape Town. So Cape Town is got a satellite with Chicago. So the Chicago scene.
Where's that show if you want to show up for that? Where's that?
That's now it's been moved because Diversity Bowl is going through construction because it's an old-ass establishment.
Oh,
it's going to be Emerald Cafe on the 4th of June, and it's going to be every Monday.
That's a nice spot.
Tell us where Emerald Cafe is.
Montrose. And if you don't know, you'll figure it out. You care about comedy, you'll figure it out.
I'm trying to help our listeners out there.
Montrose, just west of Broadway.
Comedy in Chicago is alive and thriving. If you want to do stand-up, if you want to watch stand-up, Second City is your home base. All the comedians you interact with, this city is alive and well, and we're feeding the country with comedy. I'm
so what about your zanies? Do you like working at those sorts of traditional clubs? Are those like a thing
zanies,
to aspire to?
I love doing shows out at the Improv in Schaumburg. That's your A-list comedy club here
in
the Midwest. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I was just out there having a lot of fun out there.
What are people laughing at at the Improv in Schaumburg?
Were they laughing at the Improv?
They laughing
they're
at
laughing
the improv
at Mars Timms, Chris Jones. That's what they're laughing at, Mars Timms.
You also have the Comedy Bar here, Downtown Comedy Bar.
The
they're
comedy
doing
bar.
Great. Both zanies are doing great.
Laugh Factory's doing well.
All the comedy scene's alive and well. And there's a lot of headliners. Like, I was just working with Angelo Lozada. He opens for Trevor Noah. He's the guy on Trevor Noah. And I was the MC all month at the Comedy Bar. And you literally in your room, you've got folks from all over the country. That's what's you see here in the Chicago scene is your audience is people coming from everywhere that they just wanted to come and watch stand-up and or improv.
And you guys plan to stay in Chicago.
No doubt.
Mars is like Mona was like boom on that answer. Mars
and I got some projects in the works.
But Chicago is my home again. I was born and raised here in the city of Chicago. So I was at Stroger Hospital. I was born there back when it was called the County Hospital. Number one for gunshot wounds, baby. So yeah, no, Chicago is always going to be home base, no matter who you talk to that's out there blowing up. Kumail Nanjiani, I mean, he's doing so great. I remember back when he was just first here doing shows. So yeah, Chicago is still home for everybody that comes through here and hones their craft.
So Mars is leaving.
Mars,
I'll be here.
I'm just keeping track.
I'll be here.
All right, so we can see both of you at the breakout festival coming right up.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So let's give the dates on that again.
June 7th to 9th.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at the Second City.
Up Comedy Club.
A nice room.
Go to secondcity.com for tickets, for info. You're going to get all the information.
All right, and lots of comics. So you go, you buy a ticket, you see a lot of comics.
Yes. If there is a ticket to see every single show, that's what you need to do.
All right.
Thursday through Saturday night.
Healing, especially right now, we all need healing through laughter, and that's where you're going to find it.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for stopping by, you guys.
Thanks for having me.
Mars Timms and Mona A Burmishan.
Yeah!
Awesome. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Download. It's our final half hour. This is Mark Caro and my good friend Chris Jones.
Hello there, everybody.
Filling in for Justin Kaufman on this end of the Memorial Day weekend, Monday night. It's been an eventful evening.
Yeah, we've had a great show. We've had a great show.
Lots of laughs.
We had good comics. We've had the great Mo Ryan in the studio. Rarely seen and, you know, rarely doesn't do a lot of shows, Mo. That's kind of cool.
I don't know why. She's really good at it.
No, really great at it. So that was a great show. Yeah, it was really a cool, kind of a cool thing, I thought.
I see the Golden State one.
That's good. That's good.
So you'll have Golden State. You know, it's been a year since we had Golden State and Cleveland in the finals. So, you know, it'll be refreshing for them to be paired up again.
I was watching
I
was watching the game last night. I was looking at LeBron James.
He's a big guy.
My son's claim to know secretly that he's coming to Chicago.
Oh.
They just said for pizza?
He's going to come see the comedy clubs. He's going to come see some comedy shows. I don't think he's coming to play on the Bulls.
I never know.
I don't think he's going to leave Cleveland.
I don't know.
I think it'll be too disruptive. I don't think he's going to do that.
Yeah, well, you never know.
It would be a good destination
for him. Broken news on Radio 720 WGN.
All right, Chris Jones' son says, LeBron is coming to Chicago, everyone. Tweet that. So you had an interesting piece about, I mean, they're all interesting, of course, but one of your particularly interesting pieces was talking about this plan by Live Nation to open all these new venues in that, what would you call, I guess the Goose Island area, right?
Yeah, it's called Lincoln Yards, I think is the
development. It's called Where You Go to the Hideout Now.
Right.
and where we love going to the Hideout right now, and we love that it's not so crazy built up over there. And the Rosemont Theater closing.
Yes.
Around the, and so this notion of venues and, you know, being built by developers as opposed to being the outgrowth of, say, arts groups like Chicago Shakes or Writers Theater. Would those be good comparisons?
Or the Hideout is a great example. I mean, I think, you know, so this is an interesting neighborhood. This is the area, Lincoln Yards, they're calling it. It's the area that really, I've been sort of thinking about that area. If you know that area, as most people in Chicago know that area, it's going to sort of connect Lincoln Park into Bucktown. So if you right now, if you're on the Kennedy listening to us right now and you're somewhere near the Armitage exit, you would see sort of industrial buildings and a sort of a bit of a
Morton Salt,
a couple of billboards, and you'd be like, where are we? It's a sort of weird neighborhood. And that's clearly all going to be part of this trendy new neighborhood. Obviously, they're hoping Amazon.com will be planted right in the middle of it, but I wouldn't hold your breath on that one. But that is either way, Amazon or not, there's going to be a sort of connective tissue now between
what's now Linkin Park and Bucktown. There's no question about that. And of, and the plan is that they're going to build as many as 5 different venues, ranging in size, outdoor, indoor. And it's a little, you know, it's not, the details are sort of a little bit sketchy, but they're all going to be run by Live Nation.
Right.
Which, you know, it's in the entertainment business is Byzantine, you know, as it is. And you've got Live Nation, which of course merged with Ticketmaster. Sort of, it's this, it's, so it's not, it's the, it's nothing local about it.
Right.
So what I was sort of thinking a bit about was, do we need more venues or do we need more support for what you might call the content providers, the actually what makes Chicago Chicago, what might make Amazon want to come here, it seems to me, is the, you know, the cool theater, the cool music scene. We just heard about the cool stand-up comedy scene. And yet, what, the way that, you know, when we're building things that are new, we tend to think about the building. Now, I understand a developer, that's what they think about. They're developers. You can't really expect them to sort of suddenly start forming Shakespeare companies or something. But I think it's worth saying that there's something about an organic venue. Like, let's take the Hideout, which is kind of the bullseye on the Hideout for this new development, right?
Right. It's a very small theater.
Small, but special.
Not even theater. It's a bar.
Special.
It's special. It's absolutely special. By the way, the number here is 312-981-7200. If you'd like to join this conversation, text us or call us. I was, you know, the thing that occurred to me is, it, as someone who started off, when I started off writing for the Tribune years ago, I did a lot of reporting about the music scene. And back then, before there was this national dominance of a company like Live Nation,
yeah,
it was really jam productions and then independent producers, like smaller promoters inside Chicago.
But jam
was considered like the big fish. And
yes,
now jam is a little fish.
Yes.
And that they still are actually, I mean, they're still a big organization, but they're a local organization. They program all sorts of concerts and events all over, you know, the Riviera and at the Aragon and, you know, the Chicago Theater and, you know, all sorts of theaters around here in Minneapolis, around the Midwest. You know, they're a real, you know, Chicago institution. And so when I heard about this, I thought, well, is Live Nation going to come in with their national stuff and just compete with Jam? And, you know, the World Music Theater, which then became First Midwest Bank Amphitheater, and I think it's Hollywood Casino now, that became like a Live Nation thing. And so the bigger venues were kind of being run by Live Nation. Northerly Island was one where Jam had it for years, and then all of a sudden Live Nation got it and were able to expand the capacity by a lot. So it sort of makes me wonder, is this more of one company just kind of having their fingers in every size? Because they have these smaller venues, it just gives them that much more leverage on something like, and again, I haven't talked to anyone from Jam about this. I haven't heard anything, but I just wonder whether it becomes this kind of local versus national thing going on. And that is the national development.
Well, you know, and I also think there's another interesting dilemma about, do you want to create like a second downtown? Like, in other words, do you want to create another entertainment district?
Or something that draws from downtown.
That draws from downtown. And make no mistake, it does draw from downtown. If you're 2 miles away and there's a show you want to see there, you're not going downtown. And you might argue that you can make the whole pie bigger and you can have lots of different venues. But ultimately, they do cannibalize each other. And if you look at the history around the Chicago area, you know, you can see some venues ultimately cannibalize. There's only so many shows and there's only so much audience to go around.
Right. I mean, and ultimately, you know, at the same time, and it sort of, it depends, I guess, partially on how these theaters come out. But if you're an artist coming into Chicago, there for a while, there was the sense of why, if you just go to Rosemont, then you could just get off the airplane, get off at O'Hare, and you don't have to go into the city. But now I think there are a lot of people like, boy, I'd much rather play at the Chicago Theater than play at the Rosemont. So what do you think? And then we're going to take a call.
Yeah.
But Chris, I want to know what you think is the reason for the demise of the Rosemont Theater. Is it because it's just too much of a bland convention suburban theater?
No, I think the Rosemont Theater, that was a weird one because they have that massive mall, the fashion outlet mall, whatever it's called, right there, that's so successful.
Didn't used to be there.
So successful that they need the footprint where the theater
is. So it's not that the theater's not doing well.
I also think that what happened is Live Nation ended up really betting back on Chicago. At one point, Rosemont looked like it might take a lot of business from Chicago, and then in the end, I think in the end that didn't really work out. So I think the theater was not doing great, obviously not, otherwise it would still be going strong, but I think it's also about where it is. And it tells you how much money that mall is making that they're willing to knock down a theater in order to do that.
I reviewed Elvis Costello and the Attractions at the Rosemont Theater. Yes. That must have been like 20 years ago.
It was 20 years ago.
And I remember thinking, oh, the sound is good and everything, but it was just a weird place to see this rock band.
Well, there was always speculation, you know, that it was going to be a casino. Because you went in the lobbies and you're like, this is a big lobby. Do we need all that lobby? There could be a slot machine here. Because at the time, back in the 90s, Rosemont was trying to get a casino.
Right.
And they never actually were successful in that.
It got really close.
Sort of thing. Yeah.
We have a call, but we got to go to commercial first.
All right. Well,
so we're going to go.
Hang on, caller.
So hang on there, Dan.
Yeah.
We're going to go to commercial. We're going to be right back on the download with WGN with Dan, with Chris and Mark. Welcome back to The Download for our final segment. We're on WGN Radio with Mark Caro, that's me, and Chris Jones, my friend, that's him.
How you doing, guys?
Hello. And we were just talking about the Rosemont Theater's demise and Live Nation's plan for all these new theaters in that kind of Goose Island River area. And we've got a call here from the 708. Let's talk to Dan. Hello, Dan.
Hey, Dan.
Hi, Dan. Hi, guys. How are you?
We're good.
First thing I'll say is what I said about a month ago when I called you is that you guys need to get your own show.
Oh, God bless you, Dan.
Nothing against Justin.
Your check's in the mail.
You guys have the most interesting show on WGN, even more interesting than Steve Cochran, and we all love Steve Cochran.
Well, thanks. We really appreciate that.
And I want to ask Chris something about theater, but before I say that, I'll just comment on what you said before. What we don't have anymore are guys like Bill Graham, and that's, you don't have a personality that does music. You just have corporations. So
no, but you know what, though? Jerry Michelson and Arnie Granite, I'll give them props. And I mean, people know Jerry around town. They're Jam Productions. They're not, you know, wallflowers. I see them around to things. They're not as boisterous as Bill Graham. They're not as much.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't create like the film. I mean, Bill Graham is a legend and on a national sort of scale. But Jerry and Arnie are still like Chicago guys who have been running that business for a long time. So the Jam stuff, and it's kind of like, you know, some other institutions too, where like the people who work at Jam, it's a lot of the same people who were working there when I was covering local music like 25 years ago. So there's a continuity there. So I would say, I would take Jam out of that kind of faceless corporate thing. Yeah. You could say other stuff about them, but I would not. Anyway.
No, I'm more of anti Nation, the Live Nation.
Live Nation just seems like it's
taken away. But we'll see where it all evolves to, and the whole Rosemont thing. But the other, what I wanted to ask Chris is, We look forward to your reviews.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you.
And we went to the North Light because you gave it a 4-star.
Cry It Out?
Last Saturday for Cry It Out, and it was great. And that was a great one. That's the show.
If you don't know what that is, everybody else, that's a show about babies. It's like what it's like to be a new parent. It's kind of a cool show.
Yeah, no, it is, and there was one line I took out of that show, and there was all this other, and in the end, she sat there, and I don't know if you noticed it, she said, and when she was explaining to the father that came in, that had decided to take 6 months off, and he wanted to be part of the Coffee Clutch, but she said, but you know, this is also temporary.
Yes.
And it's just, it hits home, everything really is, and we forget about that.
We do.
So don't just have to think of that. But what I wanted to ask is, how do you determine, you can only go to a show or two, maybe three a week, I don't know. Maybe more than that, my friend.
So
how do you determine what you're picking? And the reason I ask is, we give a lot to the Oil Lamp, and we go to their shows, and we like Keys out there. And I don't know that I've ever seen you do a review of one of theirs. And they just had a nice one, Nora Ephron play. And so I just didn't know what your criteria. It's a small theater, so it's only 60 seats, so I don't know. But you've done some small theaters.
Well, I would say it's a great question. I would say, you know, there's a I would say that we don't usually like, I don't like to do student shows or kids or shows with kids because I think that's no place for a critic. I try to cover every single show that's got an equity contract. That's to say, like a union show that's got a professional contract for people, because I think ultimately, you know, I try to support the profession in Chicago and good union jobs. So I try to go to every single one of those. And then I try to get around and see some percentage of the rest of it. But the reality in this city is there's 250 theaters, and there's probably 1,500 shows a year, and there's only 365 nights. And even if I go to like 250 or 300, that's only like 1/6. And I just think, you know, I try to keep my ear on the ground a bit too and find out what other people are really liking and recommending. But I honestly, I truly spend, Dan, a lot of time on it. I'm always, you know, I agonize over it every time. Hey, thanks for calling us.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dan.
We really appreciate it.
Thank you. We'll look for you out there in Glenview.
You got it. All right. Bye-bye now.
Thank you. So, Chris, no, you know, sometimes I actually feel bad for you, Chris, because that's people good. Will give you grief about what you're not doing. And I'm like, you're the hardest working man in show business. I would not be out every night like you are.
We do our best. So what are you looking forward to this summer? What are you looking forward to?
I was going
to
ask you that. What am I looking forward to? You know, I was going to give you a negative answer, which is not good, because I was going to say that, like, the music festivals, usually they're kind of like these big hit things, and I'm kind of not that inspired
Lala,
by them.
You're not inspired by Lala this year?
No, or Pitchfork.
Not Pitchfork.
But that's okay. I'm kind of looking forward to trying restaurants that I haven't tried. Like, there are, like, a lot of restaurants in town that I just haven't been to, and we just did dim sum at Duck Duck Goat over the weekend.
Oh, is that good?
Because I just hadn't been there. It's really fun, and we did it for like 11:30 on Saturday, not packed, you know, you didn't have to, you know, and it just was a delightful evening out. And it's just like, there are so many great restaurants in Chicago. And it's kind of like when you have kids and they start getting interested in this stuff. And when the younger finicky kid who never wanted to eat anything suddenly starts realizing that there's all sorts of stuff that tastes good. And like, let's go to New York so we can eat at good restaurants. I'm like, you know what? Let's go around Chicago. So I kind of want to just sort of do a little design of, all right, like, new restaurant every, you know, I don't know how often, but there are like a bunch of places that I haven't gotten to. So that's going to be one of my little projects. How about you? What are you looking forward to?
Well, you know, I agree on the big festivals, you know, and I think that's right. I'm looking forward to, I'm going to go, you know, check out the Printer's Row Festival. I think that's cool.
I always enjoy that.
Yeah, I think that's a nice,
it's a great book
it's there's not many things like that left in the city, and I like that very much. I think that's sort of cool. I love street fairs. I like the Halsted Street Market Days. I like all the Pride stuff. I like the Swedish Days up in Andersonville. That's always a good time for
me. You know what, I'll give a plug to one, Square Roots
that's a good
one. By the Old Town School. They got the Jayhawks playing this year. They have someone else good too.
There's something cool about just sort of walking through the streets, and I always think that's great. I think there's something about this weekend where you were like, you know, this is the greatest city. I was just thinking that this weekend. At the moment the sun came out, it was hot. Everyone threw all their
that's
clothes
the thing
off.
With our seasons.
Everyone jumped
everyone gets
out.
In such a good mood.
Everyone was just walking around happy. I like talked to my neighbors. That I met a neighbor I'd not met yet. I everything this weekend was just a sort of a moment when you go, you know, particularly after this very wet spring that we had, this is why we live here, and this is what makes this city so great.
Yeah, on one hand, you know, like a weekend or two in the 70s before you jump right to the 90s, that would be fine. But, you know, I was still okay with it. And the fact that the pools and beaches opened this weekend and it was like beach and pool weather, usually Memorial Day weekend, it's like,
yeah,
it can be iffy.
I don't know. I mean, really,
yeah, and you don't really want to go to do those things. So you do, you know, and then you feel like less bad about having ice cream. Have you taken the kids to Dairy Star yet this year?
No, not been there. If you don't know what Dairy Star is, it's this great kosher ice cream place on Devon.
Right by the Bunny Hutch. Which is another, you can get your little soft serve bun, then you can go to the batting cages.
And the big thing about the Dairy Star is that you can get your cone dipped in all kinds of different. It's not just your standard Dairy Queen dip. No. You can get all kinds of different flavors. So that's a great.
And you got all these Jennies all over the place too.
Yeah, Jennies. There's a lot of Jennies. Maybe too many Jennies. There's a lot of Jennies. So that's a kind of a thing. But you know. Hey, it's summer, Mark Carroll, and life is good.
It is summer. Well, I think we're going to go to break right now. We're going to go for a quick commercial right now, and we're going to come right back and wrap things up and do a little crosstalk.